Welcome.
Thank you.
It is meeting number 137 of the Evangelical Literary Guild, and this is December 24th, 2016, and it is the 28th anniversary meeting. The Evangelical Guild started in New Britain, Connecticut on December 29th, 1988. Every year, I try to think of something to say about the group, especially the founding of it, or something insightful. I try to dig up a memory or two. Well, the thing that shocked me when I moved to Boston in 92 was I was convinced that I was going to find such groups here. And I'm not saying they don't exist, but I certainly didn't run into them in any way, shape, or form. And I didn't meet anybody who had run into any of them in any way, shape, or form, which was really peculiar, I found. So that I found that really strange. And when I explained to people up here what it was, the ones who were listening and, you know, open to paying attention, it didn't strike any notes of recognition or familiarity. It wasn't like something that No. But I brought numerous people down from here over the course of time, and they all had a really good time. It was sort of like I was sort of describing, well, being at a bar, eating and drinking, and sharing writing and music, and I just for the life of me can't figure out why that isn't more common. What I found up here, which is still way more common, is I found poetry slams, which honestly I didn't feel any affinity toward. I mean, I don't know, it really struck me as strange, but I only came up with it because I knew people who wrote and because I read a book that described the idea of literary meetings. So, but it just was very strange because I think what I found up here was that, at least in the academic circles that I was in for so many years, is that there was far more competition than there was camaraderie. And it may have been because I was in graduate school. Maybe that's what graduate school is about. And maybe if I'd gone to undergrad school up here, it would have been different. But I just don't know. I just don't know. So anyway, it occurred for like, I think it went on for 2 years originally. And then I just kind of got tired of it. And so I decided to try something different. And so for a year, I came up with this other same group of people with this other concept called the Occasional Club, which was basically rather than having a group thing, each meeting would focus on one of the people in it who would just come up with some kind of idea. It could be something, if the person didn't write, it could be something like writers or whatever they admired, or if they wrote, it could be that. Which is sort of like spotlight on one person instead of a group thing, like solo albums. I think there were seven or eight of those. I mean, it was the same people, and they were open to ideas. And but then when I got to Boston, I think I just was sort of like I missed the original concept, and so I just resumed it. When I got to Boston, that's when it started really locking into about 8 meetings a year, because that's when I had to get down there and I had to really plan and organize it. And so much more became a combination of me visiting all those people from Connecticut, bringing people down there and seeing what happened. So transitioning from that, I'm trying to think of, like, I'm trying to dig out a memory. I tend to dig them out from New Britain. But maybe I'll dig one out from Portland just for the fun of it. There was that one we had with Simon, just Simon. Mm-hmm. And I think that was the December one. Mm-hmm. And it was during like a blizzard. Mm-hmm. And she didn't live far away, so I ended up walking her back to her apartment up a very steep, snowy hill. But she got there safely. It was fine. Yeah, she was a really good writer. She was kind of strange, and I don't know. It was hard to sort of get a bead on her, but and then some of the people that she was friends with were even stranger than she was. So there was that, and let's see, in Arlington, there was a time Cactus Shivers came. That was fun. He grew up with Jim, and it was a whole big to-do because he was coming from New Jersey. I have to give him credit for coming from New Jersey to Boston twice. And before disappearing off the face of the planet eventually. But yeah, that he had a really good time coming up with Jim, and they just bonded as Jim did with almost anybody. So that was good. One of my favorite memories of the Arlington one was reading the original Tangled Gate poems. That was fun because I wrote them to be published and read. Yeah, so that was fun, because that was just, like, they were just brand new to me, and I didn't know I was going to keep writing them, so it was just, it was very exciting. And let's see, New Britain, I'm trying to think of a story I haven't told you. There's not many. Originally, the back room was wood-paneled, and had these strange pictures on the walls, strange framed pictures that looked like they were gotten from flea markets or something. There was often, over the many meetings we had there, often enough to be a memory, people would come hear the music and come back and start talking. Sometime when I'm digging up, like when I'm listening to the older tapes of that stuff, I'm sure I'll find recordings of people just staggering back and starting to talk. And Jim was always very friendly to them. They'd ask him, "What is this? Who are you? What are you doing?" And Jim would stop. We'd rather stop playing if they were talking to him, or he would keep playing if they were just kind of there. But I mean, I think he perfectly understood that we were in a public place, and that we had to kind of roll with the punches. And so he didn't, he didn't get resentful or whatever. That wasn't in his nature. But so, yeah, that was interesting when people come. Usually they come staggering back drunk. And I think one time a woman came back and she was talking about her boyfriend was a musician. And there was one time someone came back and they had like a bumper sticker of their band, and they just kind of like, we just stuck it on the wall or something. We didn't have much regard for the place in terms of things like that. But I'm trying to like recall. So like the back room was divided into two rooms actually. Originally it was, you'd go up this little set of stairs from the bar, and there'd be an initial back room with about four tables. And then there'd be a doorway with no door, but just sort of a doorway to indicate another room. And that inner room is where we'd meet. And I had a habit of sitting. The seating sort of kind of became almost expected. Like people tended to sit in the same spot, which is kind of funny. So I kind of sat in the corner. I think it was partly, it might have been because there was a plug, but I think the boomboxes I brought, I tended to rely on batteries. Mm-hmm. That was something that was very funny. My recording of the Jellicle Guild, it wasn't like now with five different devices and video and stuff. It was generally whatever boombox I had that I owned and cassettes. Mm-hmm. So cassettes would click off in the middle of someone doing something, batteries would run down. I'd have a hard time finding cassettes. Or there was one time that I think is alluded to in one of the flashbacks where apparently I thought I was recording the meeting, but I was recording AM radio.
Oh, right.
The switch was on the wrong thing.
That's a bummer.
And yeah, so that, like, I was probably more paranoid about getting the boom boxes and the tapes to the meeting than I was about the Cenacle. I started recording them in 91, so there were like four solid years of recorded meetings where there was no Cenacle. It was just show up. And the only technical thing, the only additional thing was recording the meetings.
Right.
And the final thing I'll say about that, since it's an interesting thing to think about, is that the people, just anybody having access to really what would be compared to another time really advanced recording equipment, as is common now with people walking around with phones that can take pictures, record audio and video, and stream online. I mean, it wasn't, I have no pictures because I didn't own a camera.
Right.
You know, I mean, and it was like a, and even if I owned a camera, that would have been an additional layer of getting film and then getting it developed. It wasn't like you have it in your pocket, you shoot the picture and you put it back in your pocket, or you send it to someone in China, you know, 5 seconds later, you know. So recording the meetings, I mean, it was really, no one really understood why I did it. I did it because I had some level of my mind said that this thing has value and should be kept. Even before there was a cynical to associate it with, it's like I knew it was something special. And we recorded stuff, like, randomly, other than the Jellicoe Guild. We recorded things. It wasn't uncommon, because boomboxes were at least a common thing, or recorders.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, people sort of like found me recording the meetings. Some people said something, some people didn't. Nobody actually walked out, but I figure I invited you, here you are, or you can leave. I don't care. I won't hold against you if you leave, but you'll miss out on a good time. And at least for the first few years, it's like, what are going to happen to the tapes? They're going to sit in a box in my apartment and probably molder and become unreadable, unlistenable. And that's about it. But like, even when I did the Cynical, before I moved to Boston, the Cynical was done for the group of people who were sitting there. So there was sort of, and we'd done other zine type things before it became not a zine.
Mm-hmm.
But originally it had much more of like staple and photocopy quality to it. And so it was kind of interesting to them to see me take everybody's work and put it in between pages and type it up and try to make it look nice. And then the tapes of the meetings in the back were interesting, but like, if you've been at the meetings, you didn't necessarily need to listen to highlights of them. It was just sort of like I was treating the whole thing as though it was something much more than it literally was. In my mind, it was way more than it was. In my mind, it was important, and it should be recorded and kept, and it should be documented, and there should be things that emerge from it, and I thought these things, I had no context for thinking. I wasn't reading about the Inklings. The Inklings kept no records. So I wasn't like, oh, well, I had the Inklings idea of people gathering and reading to each other, but I read book on the Inklings, and the problem with writing book on the Inklings is that there's almost no, like, organized record of who came when and what happened. So I wasn't using them as, I jumped off from that idea to wanting to do, they never, like, produced a magazine or recorded anything. They just didn't occur to them to do that. I mean, they were, whatever, they were just on a different wavelength or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So it was interesting to do all that, and the thing is, I don't know why I did it all. I mean, at the time, when you can't foresee that, oh, one day there'll be an internet and websites and stuff, you know, you'll have people coming to the meeting from Israel and Austria. I couldn't foresee that. I didn't have the context in my mind. I didn't know that, like, the mad scientist guy who was telling about this internet thing that was coming, the things that were going to be possible, and you just gotta, like, come up with your good ideas now because someday they'll be realizable. Like, I had no context for thinking that any of it was, but I just found it valuable because I valued the people who came, and I valued their art, and I liked encouraging them to do it, and by operating within that context, I felt encouraged too. I mean, I it was totally the opposite of what I found in Boston, which is why I kept doing it even when I was in Boston. I think I went up there with the idea that it was going to shift.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, soon I'll be bringing my friends up to the thing that I'm doing up here, this with all these people and this cool place I found, and I'll find a way to get them all in cars. And I'll get them up here, and maybe we'll do it sometimes down there, and sometimes up here. That happened twice. I did find a place. Actually, I found two places, and I think there were three meetings in Boston. And that was fine, but it wasn't like, there was no momentum behind it. It was just ideas. It was just like me trying it out with what I had. So it's just interesting that I've never been able to exactly account for the fact, but I was an English major, but I also knew people personally who were very gifted and talented, and I liked them, but I liked them also because they were gifted and talented.
I mean, it was a combination of things. I've always liked people who had talent, found what their talent was, because I think everybody has something if they find it. And so I wanted their work to be preserved, and I wanted their gatherings to be preserved, and I didn't know that I'd be 200 miles and 20 years away and playing these barely audible recordings in an entirely different setting, but I'm sure glad that I at least did one lucky thing of that kind. So, that said, we're going to listen to flashbacks, and let me say what the flashbacks are. Okay, so, there are six flashbacks. Mm-hmm. The first one is, they're all from December of different years. The first one is from December 30th, 95, which includes random group chatter, which I usually don't include, but for the fun of it, tonight. And Jim sang a 7th anniversary song that he made up on the spot. Then December, that was December 30th, 95. December 26th, 1998, Mark Schreck reads a piece by Rico Monte. December 1st, 2001, Jim plays music. This is a song, an actual song, it's not one he just makes up. Mm-hmm. Then jump to December 20th, 2008, Cassie reads a Jude poem. And then December 18th, 2010, Melissa reads a Tom Sheehan poem. And then last year, December 26, 2015, Joel Coleman reads some Colin James poems.
As I wrote you that letter, the one where Jim and I got together that night, I don't think it was so much concern that I got into his sketch as hope that I got into his sketch.
Say,
Jim! Yeah. Holy cow!
Mr. Cousin first.
My goodness.
Good to see you.
Good to see you.
What's happening? Yeah, well, pretty good on yourself. Things are going good down in
South Carolina.
With new sets of strings. I got four new sets for Christmas on last night. That's pretty cool.
Hi, how are you?
That's pretty good.
Good.
Felt better, felt worse. A little disability going on.
Mike, will you still love me if I get a phone again?
Well, I'll love you all the more.
I would never do that. What if I got a little earring?
Some stockings with the lines down the back.
I'm going to tell you what my 90s are like.
I already know what your 90s are. Forget where I slept last night.
Anyway, the joyful thing is we've been coming to this same room for 7 years now. We haven't been thrown out yet. Not even Jim.
Keep close. I'm so close to getting thrown out of romance. Grown out of Lexus, like a marijuana tumor.
Something about the Marine you had in the kitchen or something. The weightlifter? There's a legend that Jim had one of the weight staff in the kitchen.
Rumor is, where did the kitchen get it?
Oh, car parking lot. Come on, confess it in song, Jim. Confess what happened.
Let all frozen in time and falling from the gathering like an icicle. Never back to its roots. So many people need it, so many people.
I was going to ask you if you could read Rick Amonte's Mutable Phalanx response. If you would. Have you, you haven't seen this yet, Mark, have you?
No.
Have you read it yet?
No.
Okay, good. All right, here you go, Mark. Shoot. I think you need to read this as much as for us as for you.
Yeah.
This is Rick's communication to you.
So, Thoughts on Earth, December 1998. I wish I could succinctly, and for all time, put into words my feelings, motivations, and motivations about Earth. I can only approach it obliquely, even as I see, hear, and intuit its manifestations thereof. God is unsatisfied, canny, and lonely. Creation implies response. This world we move through, physically and metaphysically, is, blessedly, open-ended. Consciousness has room, galaxies, time and space so undefined and bedraggled that the mere ordering of it, or attempts to do so, constitutes a certain evolution. Which is not to say chaos is anarchistic, but rather the crucial hint and push towards a more congenial, palatable, and communal undertaking. Mind at heart, or ideally mind heart, dies, soars, and flows through connections and divisions they it receives, and art is the lifeline to the broader realities mysteriously and nobly embodied therein. Mysterious and noble, but also evident and of the gutter. An eloquent, no-nonsense expression of what is to be sentient this time through, with particular and pertinent flourishes of why it is so. Art allows for death, for a more comprehensible death, religion notwithstanding, both a solitary leap and unitive progression into the wonder and strife of a mixed impulse. To be able, willing, and desirous to chronicle one's real and imaginary life, and to do so with reverence and to an aesthetic and bereft force, bereft because short of anything of necessary to true unity, the blazing apocalyptic merging and demonstration of the wilting ego as it flies on up to the fullness of God. Perhaps this is her.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I was timing.
You timing?
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. I untimed you.
No, no, you didn't. You didn't mess it up. It just went on.
Okay.
Because I didn't check in.
Cool.
See, Jim, I composed a 3D tone. I did. I did. I'll show it to you.
I said check.
Oh, you weren't listening. You're talking about me. Jim, this is my 3D poem. My 3D poem instructions. Smile, wake up, happiness. See, smile is E major 7th, blue. Wake up is A minor, green. Happiness is C major 6th, pink. Yeah, see? That's when I was tripping on 80 milligrams of balance. The chords I got from a friend of mine. I gave them the poem and I said, what chords should they go along with the words?
And what about
the colors are mine.
Did you hear the chords?
No.
See, you just intuited it.
Well, Smile is blue because blue is water, which is the source of life.
Okay.
Wake up is green, which is fertility and that stuff. And happiness is pink, which is creativity and art and women. The E major 7th is the one I picked because that was from my Resurrection Now poem. And the other two my friend picked.
To be a sad man behind blue eyes. No one knows what it's like to be hated, to be faded, telling only lies. But my dreams, they are as empty. Love is vengeance that's never free. No one knows what it's like to feel these feelings like I do, and I blame you. Fights back as hard on their anger. None of my pain won't, and so through. But my dreams, they are as empty as my conscience seems to be. That's never free. When my fist clenches, crack it open before I use it and lose my cool. And if I smile, bad news. Or I'll laugh and act like a fool. And if I swallow anything evil, put your fingers down my throat. And if I shiver, please give me a place. You think go on, let me wear your clothes. What it's like to be the bad man, to be the sad man, behind.
You unloaded on that one.
She recently had a friend's husband who committed suicide, and she's been very sort of torn up about that. So she said she wasn't very much in the mood for writing poetry, but she was posting these little snippets online, like replies to people's poetry on different poetry boards. And so Raymond put together a sort of a notes on how to go on from her replies that were really beautiful poetry, even though she was saying she's really just not able to write poetry right now, but she's still in. So this is the first one. One breath, one small step, a little dusting, a polish, a broom, a sudden cookie sheet, magic mix to get me through this minute, a chocolate bar to compose into chips, one stir, one mix, one short flick of a switch, I cry, I sing to the whir of the batter. I am. I do. This I can't continue. I am a giver of joy. I pledge this joy to you. Every happy face will be yours in cookie mode. You will live in every crunch of every delicious mouthful, of every mouth that crunches. This I can do. This I can do. My love I give to you. I will always give. The way out is the way in. Turn, turn, turn. An upside-down solution to an unsolvable question. Inside out, mother foe. Yeah, I said it. Yeah, yeah, mother fa. No, I don't mean maybe. It's this way and out the back door. No, Lord. No, sweet Lord. No mantra-chanting Lord. No. They went that away, the gods and goddesses of yesterday. Put on some bling, some kitsch, some instantaneous dish, some miso in a macrobiotic point of view, and off they went. How do I know? I just go. So.
I just remembered something interesting. I promised her that I would read one of her poems.
Oh, okay.
So, I'll read the next one. When tragedy strikes, mind whirls. Constant humming, waves askew. Sound too much, treble, overtones jar. I'm reeling for a friend, real sad. She's grieving, and I say how to go on. I know snow falls, and I'm wishing I could feel it. Snow falls, life goes on. Simple cycles go on, pushing for an ohm moment to go on.
Torch and cave wall, I see the writing left by others. Hold focus, you can survive this. It all will pass, 1 minute at a time. We all did it, you can do it. Listen to us sing. We did it, you can too. My battery's on full, battery may be smaller. My intentions are on high, expectations may be amorphic. Body sticking forward, tipping over, all's accounted for. What's a tooth or a hair pigment? It's all good. It's all I got going on. That's the last one.
So, we have this...
John Maciak was all bone, knees, elbows, and jaw. Hated his rifle. Proficient at killing, wanted home so badly it burned his soul. We leaned up that mountain near Yangu, frightened. War's hurricane tore our ranks, trees of us lifted by roots. I came running down 3 days later. Like cordwood, the bodies were stacked between two stakes, all Korean, but that jaw of John Maciak I saw. A log of birch amongst the scrub. I stopped. The surgeon said, move on. I said, maybe never. I'm going to sit and think about John Maciak's forever, whose fuel he is, what the flames of him will light. Perhaps he'll burn the glory of God or man. Yes.
Joe, would you like to read Colin James' poems?
All righty. I will read it.
He has two poems.
If this equinox would just get it over with. During the disorientated walk back to base camp, I was breathing pants. Our guide suffered not. The descent wasn't brief. Long vines hung in a gathering mist. The air was atheist. We rested by a stone kiosk. I heard the sound of water, our old fakir, pissing. The birds were of the rapture variety. I didn't have the strength to look that high up. A pox on your mythical warm air currents. My ankle joint had locked. I pushed with hands tense, knees contoured, senses swollen, and managed to arrive here, half in and out of view. Robbery. When moving from the comforts of a small town to live in the big city, relocate near a brothel. Voices in the dark have no shape, and fellatio can be endeared. Mornings are just that. Fuck tact, respectfully. The wind in your hair is from that song you hated. Strange man. Strange man.
That's great. That's great. That's great. Thank you, Joe. I'm going to start the reading with my Sooner's notebooks. So I sat here 2 months ago thinking, like many did at that moment, that Hillary Clinton was going to become the president and that life would go on relatively similar to as it had, because it seemed like she was kind of cut from the same cloth as Obama. And we all sat here at the last meeting and we assumed that we knew what was going to happen. And the odd thing is that we were both right and wrong. We were right in that more people voted for her than him. But unlike everything else in American politics, the president is not elected by a simple majority of voters. And so I was down in Connecticut this past week, where I've been going for the last few Decembers, where I'm from, and I go down to write and to revisit old memory points and to work on the cynical. And in this instance, I wrote more than one thing that's in this issue. The one of note at this time is from Sooler's notebooks. And I tried to write it in my hotel bed at about 4 in the morning, the night before I left to get the bus back here to Boston, and it came out really bad. It came out it sounded like a horrible mishmash of all of the various emails I get from progressive groups begging for money because of the sky about to fall. And maybe the sky is about to fall, but they all kind of end up saying the same thing. And the first time I wrote this, I felt like I was just repeating things that I had read and heard in a really uninspired mess. So when I got on the bus back to Boston, I decided I was going to try again. And I had what I'd written the night before, but I decided that I had to make it more personal, but I wanted to make it still I wanted to make it a more clear-eyed and straight-on assessment from my thoughts and feelings, and really write something that only I could write, for better or worse. I wanted to write something that only I could write. And so I came up with the opening line, and then I just decided to run with it. December 22nd, 2016, 11:15 p.m., on board Hartford, Connecticut to Boston, Mass., Peter Pan bus. Donald Trump, I believe you are a brute and a bully. You ran a scorched earth campaign for president, and you won enough electoral college votes to clinch the election. But more who voted overall voted for Hillary Clinton than you. You won based on a system that is unlike how we in the U.S. elect any other major office. But you won nonetheless. And like the brute and bully you are, you embellish this into a mandate to do whatever you please. Yet though you appeal to millions of people as somehow quote-unquote different, a quote-unquote outsider, you've proceeded to select oilmen, corporate tycoons, and insiders of all kinds for your cabinet nominees. Men, mostly, and a few women, who will work to shrink the social safety net at every turn and find new and old ways to make money for themselves and their kind. You were able to bamboozle just enough people into believing that a white male billionaire knows, and in your case cares, about the lives and struggles of most Americans. You conned enough people into thinking that your career of trucking and real estate and other businesses in the U.S. and abroad, from your massive tower in Manhattan, sums to a, quote, outsider to the establishment. American elections are blood mean things, survived by a combination of charisma and cruelty. You crushed your weaker opponents. That's what you had to do, given that you've never served in public office. But you also threatened and encouraged violence toward women, Muslim Americans, Hispanics, and members of the press.
Like the brute and bully that you are, your fist of words pummeled anyone in your way. These are the same people who will be watching you take the oath of office for president in 2017. Unlike when you run your companies as you will, you can't fire Americans. Maybe you will try. Will you? That's the question I can't answer right now, a month before you take that oath. When things start to go wrong for you, when you, like every other president, have to compromise, sometimes accept defeat, when you see your poll numbers tank, and the protests in the street, and the millions who didn't vote for you fail to stand down and cower when you rage and threaten them, will you fire us with restrictions of civil liberties, deportations, police state tactics? Or is there any chance you will stop, take a breath, another, and try to listen, take a real honest look at the damage you are doing? Find humility and its wisdom within you. Even a bully and a brute can change, can learn from experience. That's my hope for you, Donald Trump, that somewhere in you is someone who would rather be a better, more decent human being than the last man standing in a room full of bodies. I'll keep this hope for now.
I don't think it's number Pollyanna.
No, the first one did.
Oh, okay. Well, this one definitely.
The first one did. Yeah, I was trying to think about what I would say, and I just was looking for an opening line, and all I could think is, he's a brute and a bully, and that's what he is, but maybe that's not all he is. And maybe when he gets to the Oval Office, it's going to be his failures that really define him, because that's really where you don't have the votes for something, or where something's really unpopular, or where you look at the poll numbers that they all look at obsessively and see that if you do a certain thing, it's really going to hurt you. And the fact of the matter is that first-term presidents are running for their second term. I decided that, like, the first version of this, it was talking about the people who voted for him, and it was pretty nasty. I said some really nasty things that I decided that I only partially hold to. But I was just saying how your election shows that people can be fooled into fucking anything. They can be stupid enough to believe it, and sort of a mass hysteria hypnosis came over the whole society that somehow ushered him in. It wasn't like clear-eyed ushering of a person that you have a sense of in. It was just like a sort of a mass hysteria or something. Like it was this hysteria of this, like, witch hunt against Clinton that was just based on nothing. I really wish I could have talked to some Trump supporters and said, what is it you actually hold against her? Tell me about the email thing. Tell me about it. Tell me at length what it means to you. Tell me what happened. Tell me what she did. Tell me all the details that you know. And no, I don't think so. I don't think that any of it was, it was like viscera. It was viscera. And so I had some of that same viscera toward Trump. I think it was a very visceral election on all sides. And what I'm not doing is I'm not going down that mea culpa of, oh, the Democratic Party has to start listening to poor white voters. It's like, what I couldn't find a way to say was that poor white voters have absolutely no vision for the country. They have a vision for what they want, which is usually more money and sex. But, like, in terms of a vision for the country in the terms of the world, I wouldn't bet that not even just poor white voters, just most people don't have a vision, a sense of the complexities of trying to govern a nation state amongst nation states. And so, and I don't think Trump does either. And I don't think Trump, by his cabinet picks, is really, like, has any clue. But the thing with this is that I don't know what he's going to do when he gets there. You know, it's like he's going to try to use the same things that won him the election, and those things were the things that got him his success in business, and so he has these familiar moves that he believes will work, but he's no longer running against an opponent. There's no more opponent. And the thing of it is if he treats the Democrats in Congress in the same offhanded, rude way, like they're elected officials, and if he starts calling them names on Twitter and stuff, it's just going to bond them stronger. It's going to make them even less likely to work with him. And the less likely they are to work with him, one, it makes his policies harder to enact, and two, it makes it that the organization toward 2 years from now is going to be all the more
steel trap solid. I mean, there's just, it's like how he works with those people who don't agree with him and how he handles situations where it's obvious he's not going to get what he wants is really going to define him. And it really defines every president, because they all come in thinking that they're the kings of the world, they're the best that ever was, and that they're going to do it different from all 45 other of them over the course of time. And that's the only way they get to that office, is by having a kind of an ego the size of Mount Rushmore. But then how they deal with the day-to-day realities of it all is really, you know, where you learn what they're made of. And I just don't know. I mean, it's like Obama was very good at bending without breaking, and I don't know if Trump can do that. I don't know if there's any evidence that he's ever, like, been, he seems to, like, when he fails at something, he just walks away no matter what it is. And so it strikes me that, like, all these things he's promised, like, when they start saying, oh, no, we're not going to build highways, we're not going to restore infrastructure, you're not going to get that. You're going to spend half your first term fighting for that, and you're going to get nothing. He's going to, oh, well, whatever. You know, let's move on to the next thing. He's going to fight the battles he can win, because fighting the battles he can win makes him feel good. And I don't know if I believe that he has any issue that he actually, like, Clinton had issues that were really near and dear to her heart. She didn't give a fuck whether people cared or not. She was there. There was a part of her that was sincere, and there was a part of her that cared about stuff, and there was a part of her that was corrupt as hell. But I don't know where Donald Trump's, I don't know where his, like, I don't know where his sacred stuff lies. I don't know where his, the issues that he's going to fight for, whether he wins or not. It's like he's going to keep fighting for them and keep talking about them. Every president has those, and I don't know what his are. I don't know if his are not just the ones that are near to, dear to his heart are the select number among the greater number that he can win and boast about afterward, because he seems to be entirely geared toward making money. So it doesn't seem to have a moral center, and when you don't have a moral center, that could be good if you're willing to roll with the punches and get victories here and kind of victories there, give and take. But I don't know if he's that kind of guy. I mean, I think that that's going to come to pass. And I wish that he wasn't putting all these fucking Republicans into the cabinet. I really wish that he was making some effort to put some mavericks into his cabinet. Real mavericks, not like in his mind mavericks because they make as much money as him at something. But he's not putting Trumps into his cabinet. He's putting tools into his cabinet. And so, I don't know. Anyway, so that is... That's not an actual letter to him. That's just sort of that's just an address that is to him, but not a formal letter. I don't know if I'll ever write him an actual letter, but that's not it. Okay, Cassie, you're up.
Well, I thought the first thing I found a reading by B.P. Nichols of a poem that I read that somebody, he said, I start all my readings with this poem, but I thought I would start with that.
What is the poem is inside of your body, 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 body? What is the poem is inside of your head, inside your head, inside your head, inside your head? Oh, what is the poem is inside of your fingers, 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 fingers? What is the poem is inside of your toes, inside your toes, inside your toes, inside your toes? Oh, what is the poem is inside of your belly, 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 belly? What is the poem is inside of your heart, inside your heart, inside your heart, inside your heart? Oh, what is the poem is inside of your eyes, 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 eyes? What is the poem is inside of your nose, inside your nose, inside your nose, inside your nose? Oh, what is the poem is inside of your ears, 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 ears? What is the poem is inside of your mouth, inside your mouth, inside your mouth, inside your mouth? Oh, what is the poem is inside of your voice, 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 What is a poem is inside of your body, inside your head, inside your fingers, inside your toes, inside your belly, inside of your heart, inside of your eyes, inside of your nose, inside of your ears, inside of your lips, inside your voice. So what is a poem is inside of your body, 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 body. What is a poem is inside of your happy, 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 happy. What is a poem is inside of your woe, inside your woe, inside your woe, inside your woe. Oh, what is a poem is inside of your loving, 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 loving. What is a poem is inside of your breathing, 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 breathing.
Reading thing reminded me, there was a conclusion to a book that I was reading of his, like an afterword or something, and it said that the editor sent him all the poems back after they picked him out and asked him if he wanted to edit them. And he said he writes so much in like the breath line of where he's at when he's writing, or like he wrote these a few years before and he was in such a like he was in a really dark place, and his breath line is like much always trying to catch his breath and stuff, like trying to re-edit it when you're in a different breath line. That's he just couldn't do it, so he just left them as they were. Well, there's one more BP Nickel. I can do a whole BP Nickel turn if you want.
Okay.
And then next time we just... So this is from a book called Beachhead, 1970. So this is the book that had the two sections, Sea and Land, and at the end, DR sent these back to me and said, could I make any questions or changes to these? I wanted to and send them back. I couldn't. I made only one poem different and left it up to him. I am no longer the person I was when I wrote these. My musculature is different, and as a result, my breathing. Breath lines that made sense then no longer make sense. The land section, one long poem, has a panicky short breath line I was in at that time. That poem written in a period of time that terror ruled me as never before since. If I change it now, it would make no sense. What could be more illogical than to look back and say that the breath line makes no sense when in fact that was how I breathed then? These poems are offered up in friendship to whoever hears them and breathes them with their own body. Okay, but anyway, I'm going to read it from the C section, not the panicked land section. This one's called A Letter in January to Wayne and Julie Clifford. Having risen from the bath, old images return, sea moving into me, only the echoes left. What moves now are ghosts, hosts of the old forms. As ships moved westward where a continent crumbled, having struggled this long, what the eye sees leaves no return from that one journey that accords a turning to your world, a shift of forces. This night the sea moves into me, dark street, no way of sailing over it, and so I must move through it alone, nameless, and walk beyond my life. But the words are on me, hang heavy, and the voice cries to be heard, inside me all, inside me, dark world. We can say the nets end, return full circle, and the actual untangles its confusions. The world is given its history. His story never changes. Some journey is done, and the ear gathers the words near to measure what one has won.
That's nice. I can see it. It's kind of an important space.
Mm. Well, apparently the land section is darker.
That's pretty good.
And all of these books, I mean, I don't even need to buy any of these books, but they're all for free. I mean, unless I want an actual physical one.
Yeah.
But they like, are actually scanned in, like, you can see what they actually look like. And,
oh, nice.
Yeah, the covers.
That's pretty cool. What do you do for work?
So he was part of that Four Horsemen, music group, kind of. One of his best strengths was his ability to collaborate with other artists. The work of the Sound Poetry Group, the Four Horsemen, has been documented.
So he was kind of a performer.
He collaborated with Stephen Cafferty to form the Toronto Research Group. I mean, those are all performance groups. And he did lots of, Nichols' zest for publishing other writers was reflected in founding Anglia Press with David Aylward in 1964 and Gronk in 1967. He was a volunteer editor at Coach House Books from 75 until his death. He edited, designed, published, and distributed the works of worthy writers through collectives, including editor of Open Letter and Literary Magazine.
Huh.
Also had a large presence in TV, wrote for TV shows.
Hmm. Well, that makes sense. He kind of cobbled it together from performing and writing.
Yeah.
I think I'll start with Joe Coleman. So this is entitled Christmas in the Compost Pile. It's Christmas in the compost pile. Beneath a cloak of snow, thousands of mindless pagan pests are laboring below in layers of soil and animal waste and rotting vegetation. They don't share gifts. They don't send cards. They hang no decoration, for theirs is a world of slow, relentless, organic, putrid decay. These nasty mini monstrosities are slimy pink and gray. They have no wassail, spiced rum punch, or festive Yuletide drinks. They only have real dirty dirt. It really, really stinks. There is no fragrant balsam tree. Why ring a silver bell? Why ho ho ho? Why sing Noel? It smells like holy hell. They feel no need to kneel before the newborn babe among us, a slipping slide bacterial and creeping crawl cross fungus. It's just a biodegradable day, Christmas in the compost heap. Sugar plum visions mean nothing at all, for maggots never sleep. They've never heard of Rudolph, nor of Santa, nor his elves, yet compost sends a thrill through every segment of their selves. So think of those wiggling worms who toil as you tip your glass of sherry. They slave such odorous holiday hours, but I hope yours will be merry. You may wonder where this poem came from. Long story. Sorry I won't be with you on Christmas Eve 28th anniversary gathering. Have fun. Enjoy health and happiness. Hope despite Trump. And I sent him back a text message saying thank you for the poem, may 2017 surprise us all in good ways. So that was his Christmas poem. Maybe he'll be here next year and we'll have him do an encore himself. Okay, so moving on to his poems that he sent me. I think he actually read some of these last time, but I'll be his cover band tonight. Coffee with no goodbye. Often we stirred our thoughts there, drank lots of coffee, poured ourselves out, spilled feelings, filled each other's cups to the brim there, conversing sweet and light, often percolating, sipping slowly for so long. We savored our fine blend there so many times, until that one day, that one certain strange cup of coffee. That strange cup seemed too hot, too bitter, too dark. It tasted like a burning bridge. I might have given it time to cool, but I obeyed my clock without pity. So I went outside for a cigar and left you sitting alone, coffee barely touched, bridge burned, ashes on my tongue. Non-invasive. If this were a lancet, scalpel, or knife, I'd slice through meat and bone to the heart of the matter, exposing pains. This is a pen in my hand. It slides on the surface of things best left alone. Feelings don't splatter. There are no stains. Take the pen to paper sheet. Ink will make the chaos neat. Ink is slower to congeal. It is safer to think. It hurts to feel. Horatio at the Mullion Dance. Bravely he endured a lifetime of inconsequential catastrophes, negligible calamities, and trivial disasters until that broken shoelace done him in. Okay, your turn. What do you pick?
Paradox. Something from nothing, a relevant theme, holding two winds together, a sensible scheme. a common thread tied into all nature's weaving, also tied up in the soul's set plans for leaving. Solar rising and setting, the main fundamental, cyclical time with its force elemental, then linear time with its future past thought, all balanced together a new consciousness wrought. To live deep in the present but still interact in social dimensions is an ennobling act. The tension primordial yet manifest here, inside time and out, so far yet so near. Ambiguity, feeling, subjective emotions, more of a guide than the more abstract notions. Hold in your heart a conflicting objective, align with the cosmos, the deepest directive.
Yeah, that's a little something to it. Mm-hmm. All right, so I'm going to pick next Colin James. Mm-hmm. He sent me a bunch, and I picked out one, two, three, four. Yeah, I picked out four. Here we go. The conceptual, it's an experience. A technician or gaffer, independent of the special effects person, placed the clear glass table down directly over the cameraman who lay on his back. The youngish model squatted on the table and shat succinctly, in good order, two formidable turds. This particular angel of defecation was inspired by the Franco Canarvo School of Cinema, Northeast. Essential attributions and shortlisted theories remain in a shoebox with no lid. I looked up Franco Canarvo. He wasn't a filmmaker. He was like a painter or something. And I don't even know if that's what he means or if he just made up that name randomly. But I was just curious if there was a Franco Canarvo out there. And there is someone. But I don't know if it's who he's referring to. A non-compliant student venting to a gamer. Normally wouldn't matter, this wheelbarrow of a behind I carry, swollen with parenthetic passion. All the urges that twist torque, such as a rendezvous not kept by eye looks and armpits, dismissive of whatever is not there. My walk has become uneven. Two legs loiter without thinking, then follow along systematically present. Shoes worn inside out, upside down. The leather is rubbing, becoming opinionated. Can't say as I agree with that. And the rocking chairs are masturbating all over my perishables again, having never made peace the first time. I don't know what to think about his work. I know that there's a certain groove in it that I tend to select from the bunch he sends me, but I don't know what they mean. Mm-hmm. I don't know what they mean. The Drake Mars experiment in the title of the next poem, I think Drake is some kind of scientist, and I think Mars being referred to is the planet Mars.
Okay.
But I couldn't find online when I was looking a specific Drake Mars experiment. But it seemed to be like this Drake guy was like, there's this famous guy named Drake who is part of SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, that project. So maybe he's referring to that guy. I don't know.
Okay.
That's the closest I came. When I Googled Drake and Mars, I also came up with like Drake the singer and Bruno Mars, whatever. An old friend found wandering incognizant near the Drake Mars experiment. Your god, at the height of her powers, had just placed an imitation carnation on the sculptured rocket. I wasn't thinking of penises nor ballerinas as I helped you to your car. The back seat was full of rubbish and you smelled like burning hair. The crumbling chain link fence was not hard to see beyond, so I drove you home through and past deliberating loiterers. You thanked them all personally with all the adjectives you could still find. And finally, Isaac, the dark-eyed wanderer. Arguing winds, I can't get a word in. My lips are internalizing. Gratuity, I was promised a seasonal share, wheat and fatalistic rye for the dead of pride. It's in the rock, it's in my hair, it's in my shit. I consented to this, to walk the whole year vicariously. Next.
I guess I'll do Martina.
Okay.
White Road. Amino de una gotia de sangue remane in me che non trema. Less than a drop of blood remains in me that does not tremble. Don't throw me no drag now, she said. I don't. I won't. While you still hear me, I'll tell my tales as candidly as I can. These are wretched times, times that poems cannot fix, and we are living them. We are stricken with lies and food that leaves us hungry, and the vivid marks of war like stripes on the back of our souls. This is what I ask of you, that you stay to the end of this poem, at least this one. While you still hear me, there are things you should know. They may be bruised, but there are still apples, tart and cool from a tree. And while the sky is definitely falling, there are, now and then, patches of beryl, cerulean, and icebergs still haunting it. We are not kissed by fortune, nor blessed by happenstance, so there is reason to fear. And that being said, while there may be hardened by, while they may be hardened by work, by slavery, by rancor, or pain, there are still hands, warm caresses on our heads. And while the nourishment of good sex is undervalued and turns sometimes into revenge, the bare calves of a lover beneath a quilt still sustain and condole. I'll throw you no drag, no matter what. I say live, even precariously, even sadly. Live, you who are left to listen, as though the notion of life intrigues you, as if living is all there is to do, even as it remains a variety.
A variety is kind of like a mere wish.
Hmm. Okay.
I looked it up several places, and it's somewhat ambiguous word, but I think it means a merest wish. It's like not even like a hopeful wish, like the barest of wishes, which kind of fits the rest of the tone. All right, so I'm going to read Victor. Victor read this one time when he was here, so I'm going to be his cover band again. Rally of the Damned. My brothers, we are the losers. A conjoined singularity, the collective of the lost souls who, having drunk too much malt liquor the night before, stumbled on the train tracks close to home, to be found later, dismembered and dew-covered, baptized into their new lives. We will never be like the pipe smoke and sweet black coffee of our grandparents, as much as we try. Instead, we are covered in the scent of our work, burning the insulation from electrical wires for that tiny bit of money it brings. We have the lingering flavor of hemlock and monkshood. My brothers, let us gather together and mock the promise of balanced serotonin levels and symmetry of limbs. Let us come together with our look of a creature from a children's fairy story, twisted in appearance from living under the woodpile of imagination, wretched from racking ourselves into the unnatural forms that we might supposedly please our beloved families. For others, had of the cleansing light of a new morning. For us, it was the harsh and blinding radiation of a solar god's judgment. Others had the swallowtails and cicadas, but we were left dead flies and dust trapped between the panes of glass of a window painted shut. Our world, with Bukowski as our high priest and Burroughs as our prophet, we again open our eyes when the pains we suffer let us sleep no more. Our world, where we go hungry, not because of the endless bounty that surrounds us, but that we have no mouths. My brothers, let us again gather together, much like the woodlouse and termite in the crumbling woodpile of our lives. We are like doves that, trusting their instincts, fly deliberately into glass. We are like petrified driftwood that, while retaining its shape and recognizable form, cannot be used as fuel to warm others' lives on cold nights. My brothers, let us gather together in the comely marriage of rotten darkness to celebrate the failing meat bodies we wear. Let us join hands and sing our psalms though we had no mouths. Let us come together and dance in our writhing, awkward fashion. Let us take comfort in the fact we are not alone, unclothed in the Serengeti anymore. Now we are alone and together. Let us pray.
I guess that leaves me with Tom.
Sure. This is an interesting one.
Pick up kid brother Charlie to astronaut. This star reconnaissance began on the 4th of July, quick morning soft as a fresh brook bun, as warm air floating upstairs and coming across my bed in the smell of burnt cork or punk as smoky as a compost pile rising upwards from lawn debris night had collected. Sped rockets askew in gutters throughout the town, wide clutter of half-burnt paper and tail sticks themselves once afire in the nightly sky, signals that gave darkness a newer dimension of lightness and sound, and the explosion of circular flares too bright to look at, as if the sun had delayed departure for the heart of our celebration, as if stars had loosed their final demise amid the spatial junk they might encounter in our outer reaches, friction of them in the measure as silent as Indians in the past on those fields and paths of flint and rock, even as children younger than I was went secretly about their ways in quiet roads and padded lawns, collecting extended shafts of excitement, rolling them into fistic quivers of their hands, tightly against their noses, smelling the residue of them. Drops and dregs of sky-reaching powder that shore fires had implanted on their thin shanks as black as the night was, so that when amassed in one child's hand, a match was reapplied in secret, and the gut blaze of the celebration began anew for those without money to buy their own pyrotechnics. The red, blue, red, and orange-green flames, loosed by this competition, excelling much I might have seen on the holiday eve. These young scavengers, that young army of excitement seekers like a fresh wind adrift on the dawn, my younger brother Charlie, one of the aimless searchers of ignited celebration goods, marked all the way across a vast lawn where the flag was left hanging out all night by his red hair and fiery eyes aglow, even before the false dawn flashes, nimble legs in dry gear and nimble fingers at the bundle sticks awaiting new flame. Oh, my younger brother Charlie, long ago appointed to the same bedroom as I, who would decorate the walls with Neil Armstrong's little dance down the ladder of time, and across the tide of skies, blur of our black and white television set, this younger brother of mine, who dreamed and reached the stilted aerodynamics of glass, who exaggerated his heart and his agile mind for the unseen, the unknown, that deepened pit of darkness the skies offer to imagination leaping for the wonder of endless contact, sweet abrasions of the universe and all its part, coming global wanderer, aeronaut and astronaut and star traveler, now out of the tightest innards of the smallest bedroom, Neil Armstrong carried on his back, this fiery-eyed, dreamy, celestial kid brother in endless orbit, and sending me these late signals from far turns of the once dark universe whose reception began in ample ignition beneath fisted hand, like a wondrous booster for his telltale heart, now making no sudden move. Goodness. That is one long sentence.
Yep. Yep, that's one of his infamous one long sentence poems. Yeah, but it's interesting that it took me a lot to figure out what the hell it was about, and then, oh, okay, so it's about 4th of July,
yeah.
The next day, all the kids are trying to find spent firecrackers
yeah.
and see if any of them have any gunpowder in them to shoot them off again.
Yeah.
So there's that.
Not that much.
And then it kind of shifts to Charlie, who's one of the searchers, who admired the astronauts
yeah.
and had a poster of Neil Armstrong
yeah.
Coming down off the ladder onto the surface of the moon. And I think the last bits of it, I think Charlie has passed. I think Charlie's died at some point because I think that he's remembering Charlie from a long time ago and now making no sudden moves. Yeah, from far turns of the once dark universe. So I think it's just like him recalling this memory very vividly from a long time ago
yeah.
of a brother who had long since died.
Yeah.
So
I agree.
It's one of his poems that is structurally demanding, but it's emotionally satisfying. It, like it has a there's something there to like to experience. You just have to like go with him on the way he's doing it.
Absolutely.
You know. So as part of my going down to Connecticut for several days to edit the Cynical and also to write stuff, this piece emerged probably, it's best said, from two things. One, people who've said that they don't understand my writing, like Joel Coleman and Charlie Beyer, and they wanted to explain to them. And so I had it as a backup plan, because my actual plan was to read through all of my writing for the past 4 years as you're writing poems. And I just ran out of time. And I decided that the reading through was, like, if I had to sacrifice writing in the short term, I've now reconnected with all that writing in the long term. And I was stalled. I mean, that's what this was all about. I was stalled. And I thought, I've been writing this stuff in various forms for 4 years, and I'm stalled. That's not encouraging. I'm not usually stalled. I'm stalled enough that I'm not writing these major things, or rather, I'm not writing many musics, and I'm stalled on Dykes and Newtons. I'm still writing Labyrinthine, but Labyrinthine is easy because Labyrinthine has no expected structure, and I just do with it what I want. I don't even think of it. It's just, I wouldn't put crap in it, or what I thought was crap in it, or I would try not to do that. I would not be careless with it, but I don't think of myself as having to do any particular thing with it. It's a laboratory. It's the most blatant laboratory I have. It's where if I want to write about something different, I just start a new section. If I'm not enjoying what I'm writing, I just write a long M dash and start a new section. And if I want to go back and decide, oh, well, I need to, like, connect all this stuff together, I'll go through it for 5 hours and I'll pick out all these little things and I'll pick up on all these narrative threads and I'll just drive them along. It's, for some reason, it's not hard. Many music has gotten hard because it's been prequel poems for, like, 2 years. And I'm at this point where I came up with this brilliant and dubious idea that I would rewrite the original poems. I was going to do that this December. I was going to write them 36 days in a row. I didn't know what the hell I was going to do, but it was my brilliant idea. And when I realized I wasn't going to, and then I realized how much I wasn't going to, it really disturbed me. And I thought, you know what, you're trying to, like, pull tricks where tricks are not going to work. You know, it only worked 4 years ago because I was writing these disparate things that were getting closer and closer to each other, and then all it took was me just finding a kind of like a apparatus to bring them all into. And that was the Greek labyrinthness. But here I am 4 years later, and I'm really stuck because I spent 4 years just driving forward on momentum. And at some point I realized that I told these stories in so many different ways and used these characters over and over again in so many different ways that, like, was there any grounding at all to any of it? And so if someone asked me, what is this angle? This is what I finally came up with on the bus when I was out of time. Like, I was out of time, so I wrote the 3-page letter to Trump, but that was, like, sort of my plan. I didn't have any other ideas, but I definitely had a visceral response to Trump. And I managed to keep it to my level of control, which is, I don't like you, I distrust you, I think you're going to be a really horrible president, but I'm not sure. And you're not sure, and nobody's sure. Until you take the oath of office and start doing shit, I can't actually be against you. And that's probably the Hartley influence. Hartley is the only Trump supporter I know, and I respect him so much that I'm willing to give Trump a shot. If nothing else, when he fucks up, and I'm sure he will, I'm going to say, Hartley, I gave him a chance. In fact, I might even send him one I wrote and say, this is me giving Trump a chance. This is me saying, I think you're a rat bastard motherfucker who's never treated anybody good in your life, and you're going to try to pull the same shit in the White House, and it's not going to work because it's not your company. And in 8 years, you're gone. Or in 4 years, you're gone. Or really, in 2 years, you can be disemboweled of any real power you have. But you get that shot. You get that shot. All these people voted for you. You have an antiquated, stupid electoral college system that somehow is supposed to prevent the tyranny of the majority over the minority. It's like, well, what about the tyranny of the minority over the majority? I mean, like, what about tyranny of anybody over anybody? I mean, just what about the tyranny of stupid ideas? Whether they're held by most people or few. You know, because there's lots of stupid ideas held by lots of people, and there are lots of stupid ideas held by a select few. You know? So it's like, tyranny comes in all packages. I don't know, whatever. So I wrote that because I was down to a bus ride. And once I'd written that, then I looked at what I spent 3 days reviewing, and I decided, okay, so Charlie Beyer asked me, he didn't actually literally ask me, but I said, oh, well, sometime, don't worry about writing about my stuff now, sometime I'll explain it to you. And he said, quite honestly, see, if you explain it to me, I'm sure I'll appreciate it. So this is my, this is not exactly a response to him, but this is my attempting to explain the Tangled Gate. And you'll see what you see. Notes from New England. Please accept this ragged purse of high notes. What is the Tangled Gate? Note, it's been 4 years I've been writing on the Tangled Gate myth in various forms. Many musics, labyrinthine, bags of news, dream raps. Decided to spend several days rereading it all and see what I came up with. Once upon a time, there was a planet called Amandia. On this planet lived a nearly immortal race that created a high civilization that prospered for thousands of years. But their planet began to suffer degradation. Its biosphere was flawed for some reason and waned over time. It could not sustain this race. Fortunately, there were those in Amandia who had foreseen this possibility. These individuals contrived an idea to find other habitable worlds and plant beacons on these worlds should a time of need come. These gates would provide a safe landing place. Here's where the story gets stranger. There's no technology in existence to build and transport these gates to habitable planets. Amandians had very slight physical forms, and their world of wide seas and forested islands had never been cleared for the building of cities like ours. Best way to describe it is to say they do not divide their lives as we do into waking hours and dreaming ones. So what they did was to cast out their query for someone who could build their gates. And they met the architect this way, a young man who was a powerful dreamer studying architecture at university. The architect had been an unmarked young man until this contact in his dreams. But this changed him. The Amandians taught him how to better control, direct, and travel in his dreams. He, in turn, studied with a new and varied focus to become a master of architecture. He contrives the gate, what he calls the Tangled Gate, for the strange qualities its walled interior scape possesses, and builds it over many years in a series of dreams. The Amandians gift him the same near immortality they have. I don't know yet how they turn gates built in dreams into physical objects. I tend to think they are a hybrid of waking and dream material, like what is contained within their scapes is dream world matter. Amandia collapsed over millennia. Perhaps its sun collapsed. Perhaps this compromised its atmosphere. The process accelerated slowly enough for the worry to travel vaguely along the centuries. Then it accelerated more quickly, but still nobody acted. When it was nearly too late, there was a convocation of leaders. Leading this world was an anathema to them, but there seemed no choice. But how to do so? There were gates in far worlds, but how to reach them? Working with the architect, they build the Red Bag. This is a dream portal from Amandia to the gates. The catch was that whoever took this route would not be able to leave the perimeter of the gate to live in the rest of their new world. They would sacrifice the physical parts of themselves by this method. So another method was created, also created. Space capsules were created, and a kind of freeze-dried Amandian DNA was contrived for travel. If the capsule hit salty seawater, it would activate this DNA, and an Amandian, too really, would emerge, rise to the surface, perhaps survive. The assumption was that some of these worlds would fail to provide good homes, and the Amandians would use the Red Bag to transport to another. Perhaps the ones in the capsule would have better luck. It was all a gamble. Another version of this says that the capsules contained Amandians chosen to assess a world beyond the confines of the gate and deem whether it was worthy of settling. Another aspect of all this were the creatures. They were natives to the planets the gates were sent to. Originally animals of an ordinary kind, the gates' arrival on the islands they lived on developed in them consciousness and sentience, and awareness of what Amandia and the gate were. Creatures are very important to the Tangled Gate stories. The Amandians failed on many worlds to find their new home and would move on. The consequence of this on the planet was catastrophic. The closing of a gate would annihilate a world's ecosystem, destroying it. One more important note about the gate coming to a world. These worlds were chosen for how they resembled the forest islands and wide seas of Amandia. What would happen to the particular island where the gate landed was that it would, like the creatures, become conscious and aware. A being, a beast, would emerge from it, a moving personification of the island and all upon it. The Amandians would have some control of the beast, but not all. Stories of the Tangled Gate, Amandians, beasts, and so on would often circulate among the natives of the planet. Since Amandians would have caused their worlds to develop life such as men and women, and since Amandians lived among them, usually shaped like men and women as well, though a native form of Amandians have no certain gender, mythologies would grow up of gods and goddesses from the sky. sometimes individuals would try to find the island, the gate. Sometimes they would. There's always more to discover about these strange stories.
But don't you think that's a good explanation? It is an explanation.
It was because I'd been immersed in it all for 3 days.
Of course, yes.
That was the only way I could write that, because I had it all in my head. Like, I had the Bag's End version of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny that the dried DNA thing sounds like Sea Monkeys.
It does.
I was thinking, oh, God, stealing Sea Monkeys' ideas. Sea Monkeys in space. You know, like, I realized another idea I vaguely kind of sort of could be compared to, though I don't really think I used it. I don't really think it's an inspiration, is Avatar. Because the Avatar, don't those, whatever the blue people are called, they live in the forest world.
You're not feeling ideas after
night. It just struck me that there was a similarity. But I was trying to figure out, how would you choose the worlds that you would choose? You would choose worlds similar to your own that could sustain life forms like yourself. So they chose forested island worlds with big seas, because that's what they, like, that helps to explain, like, I was thinking basically the Earth has 6 continents, or technically 7. I mean, like, we call them continents, but they're islands. And they're, some of them are attached to each other, but, like, basically they're based big. There's 6, let's see, there's North America, South America, Asia, or like the, whatever Europe is, Euro-Asia, Antarctica, and Australia. Okay, so maybe there's Africa, yeah. So there's 6 continents. And in my story, there's 6 islands. I mean, I think I didn't really, I wasn't, see, like, what I had to come to grips with is over the course of the 4 years, I started with, you know, this much, and then it got, I kept, like, moving into it in different ways, and, like, when it was in the Bag's End stories, it was, like, one thing, and, like, there's a whole story about how Chrissy's trying to find her sister. And her sister, in the Many Musics Tangled Gate story, is the demon. But she's not actually a demon. She just becomes demonized because of, like, circumstance. Like, different major portions tell the same story in different ways, because I was playing with the idea of it, and then I realized I played with it so much that I didn't know exactly how to move forward. You know, I was like, I was literally stuck as to what made sense next. So I think this helped. I mean, I have like 40 pages of notes. I didn't exactly take them like I was going to refer to them all. I kind of took them as the way you take notes in a class. Yeah, just, you write it, it helps you focus. You know, if you're reading something and writing it out, you're as, you know, and so, so that's where I was at with that.
Once more, we drove the cows away. Otherwise, it was a quiet morning. Smiling, Joaquin's wife, Maribel, brought us 6 small sweet bananas, the only food we'd eat that day. Luis and Xiomara and Macias came around and hung out for most of the afternoon. Luis carved a miniature canoe paddle for me out of balsa wood. I used a magic marker to write an alphabet for him and his sibs on the wood chips and spelled some words in Spanish. Dave told them about the divine immortals from the books he reads on Taoism. They're like Winiwai, he says, and about the Jade Emperor, who's like Nyan Yin, God, the Creator. Aguilar sauntered up, his arm still black and swollen in its sling. Good morning. Morning, I said. How are you feeling? A little better. My hand still hurts a lot, but I read some of that Bible you gave me. Are you guys Christians? We're Jews, Dave answered. Ah, Jews, Aguilar nodded. What part of the Bible were you reading? I asked him. Some Psalms and some Proverbs. Why need I fear when evil times come? Only my own sins can ensnare me, I quoted, translating the passage into Spanish with difficulty. What's that from? Psalm 49. The Psalms were supposedly written by King David, the guy his name comes from. Ah, King David, sure, the one who killed the giant. It's been too long since I read the Bible. It used to give me so much strength. Lately, I've been lazy about reading it and sharing it with my kids. I realize this bite is a punishment, a reminder. A reminder, Dave Eckert? Yeah, I made a deal with Jesus. I dedicated my life to him, and he washed away my sins. I need to remember that. Your interpretation, I said, of why you got bitten is interesting to me. Last night it seemed I saw a demon feeding on you through the snake bite. No, I think God himself sent the snake to bite me. Ever tried yahe? Dave asks. Yeah, one time, a bunch of years ago. I'd been in a stupid and destructive period in my life. I was drinking too much, chasing women, staying out all night at parties. After the healer gave me yahe, I felt I went to hell. I saw devils flying around, torturing the souls of the damned. What did the devils look like, I wanted to know. Like devils, I said. Red with bat wings? Of course, and I realized I was going to end up there if I didn't change my life. Completely, immediately. At that moment, I prayed to Jesus and asked him to wash away my sins. Later that night, I went up to heaven. I saw Jesus. The next day, I restarted my life. I met my companion a little while after and married her, and we've been together ever since. The buzz of the motor canoe on the river intensified, then stopped. Aguilar's father strolled up the path, light on his feet, white-haired, slender, dark-skinned. His son, feeling good enough to go home, the two men left. Dave took off his crown, lay down on a foam mat, closed his eyes. Soon he was breathing deeply and regularly. I lay in my hammock, eyeing my broad, squarish feet, the pale, smooth skin, the sparse brown hair, the short toes Deirdre insisted looked like squid tentacles. I remember Deirdre telling me she sometimes felt her own toenails were watching her like eyes. I pondered the snake bite mystery. Maybe the bite just happened because the snake perceived Aguilar as invading its personal space. Snakes usually respect human space because we're strong in it, and it doesn't benefit them to invade. Plus, they don't want to waste their poison. Joaquin came over at dusk and sang a lilting song over a cup of yahe for each of the three of us, beginning with himself. Then he wrapped himself in a blanket against the chill, curled up in a hammock, and fell asleep. I lay down on a mat on the floor, wrapped a blanket around myself, laid my head on my folded sweater, a black one Deirdre had given me for Christmas, and slipped into a tidal wave of unconsciousness. I'm smashed by a tremendous force. I'm in the severest agony. Time has stopped, and the moment explodes into a punishment of infinite pain that lasts forever and ever and ever. At the far side of forever, I wake in the dark, in a new world of pain. The only difference is time's running. I remember where I am, but I'm on fire inside. Whole body burning. Can't move. Can't think. Can barely moan. In a word, dying. In his hammock, Dave clears his throat and sings, "Every rainbow has a skull for a head. That's what I saw when I woke up dead." Like anything else that might have happened at that moment, his singing makes the pain worse. I want Dave or Joaquin to save me from this hell, not sing. Every cell in my body is screaming. At last I manage to struggle to my feet. I throw back my head and bellow in Spanish. "God, you want to kill me? Then kill me now. I'm ready. Look me in the eye and kill me." Seething with energy, silent, I'm within death, a dark antechamber of wind. I peer around, I contemplate it, I pull out of it, alive. So death's a change of scene, another kind of puberty, an initiation, a maturation. And when we die, we leave our old ways behind and go exist in a more advanced way. And I'd gladly die to save the life of any of Rufino's kids in the hut next door. and the old died to free up energy on Earth for the young. And Dave's relatives who died in concentration camps watch him from the sky to which they rose as smoke. They look just like stars, the stars of David. Dave sits up in his hammock in a cloud of stars. I tell him about the infinite pain I felt. He nods. I mention I poked my head into the realm of death. He nods and begins to speak the things on his mind. I can't yet focus on what he's saying. My inner noise is too loud, and the stars are too bright. But slowly, ever so slowly, in my infinite wisdom, it enters my thick, rainbow-tailed skull that Dave was also experiencing difficulty at the same time I was. I realize this after he tells me so several times. For him, it was two anacondas made of fire, squirming and lashing out inside him, burning his brain and guts to ash. Now that we both feel fine, so we climb down off the hut and stand on the grass and stretch and talk. Me. And this old Kabbalistic theory I was reading about last year said there's reincarnation among Jews. It doesn't say anything about other people. This was just talking about Jews. And it said that all the Jews who were alive today were present at Mount Sinai when Moses brought down the tablets of the law. It's all the same people, but it's not direct reincarnation, like one person then equals one person now. But like there's bits of each of them and each of us, like a bit of Samson in my elbow and a bit of Adam in my chin. But then it also seems like there's, like it's more like I get this flash of you being King David and me being the prophet Nathan, who is this prophet David hired to tell him what was up with God. And it feels like we had the same exact conversation in the desert 3,000 years ago, Dave, and wondered if we'd ever have it again in the future. And the answer was, yeah, of course, absolutely. And also we'll have it again in some far-flung future, in some far-out galaxy whilst smoking a spliff on a newly discovered rainforest planet. And like now, we'll recognize that we're ancient people reincarnated in modern times to manifest the true and proper religion of world peace and brotherhood and respect that all people know intuitively but can't usually make happen in their daily lives because they are infected with the diseases of modern society like ignorance and greed and gluttony. So in this life, we need to open our eyes and be absolutely righteous, keeping ourselves clean from the temptations of materialism and consumerism, following the examples of the highest, purest, divine immortals. And the challenge for us is to remember that, to hold tight to that truth, to learn the ancient traditions, and never let them fade away. His voice echoes in my ears. Away, way, 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 way. Pausing, we echo ourselves in the ringing silence of this shadow of language, eternal like mountains and clouds, and like them, drifting. When the nausea finally comes, it's gentle. In the spirit of the gleaming machines of the Café Trieste, I intone, we make cappuccino for the grass, we make espresso for the earth. The ahé is even sweet as it gurgles up, and frothy like steamed milk. After spitting out the last of his, Dave remarks, Don Ignacio told me Quechua shamans sometimes re-drink the ayahuasca they vomit up. They puke into gourds, then drink it back down. Right. It's pure, I say. When you fast, you get clean inside. And there didn't seem to be any stomach acid in that dose I just threw up. Dave nods. The stomach doesn't digest it, just passes it on to the intestines. The clouds have parted to reveal a huge, yellowy-golden crescent moon, parallel to the ground, a hand's width above the trees, its horns pointed up, the very image of a Sumerian cow goddess. I send her my love. I feel like sending a fax, Dave says. A fax? I echo. A fax to Fujimori. Explain. Alberto Fujimori, the Japanese Peruvian dictator president of Peru. He ordered the invasion of Ecuador's jungle territory south of here 8 months ago. I know who he is. The press says he's like a modern samurai. How are you going to send him a fax at this time of night in the middle of the jungle? By taking a crap, that's what people say here in the Oriente, the Ecuadorian Amazon. Fax paper's like toilet paper, right? Both come in rolls. So when you crap, you send a fax to Fujimori. Ah, tell him I say peace. Will do, old shoe. King Dave zigzags off across the grass. I climb into the network of my hammock and pray for peace. A blue nine-pointed star appears before my eyes, etched in crisp neon lines in the air, and vanishes. I want a tattoo of it on my shoulder, and maybe I'll shave my head and have six eyes from different animal species tattooed on my scalp in honor of the hunting spider from yesterday afternoon. That'd be nice for ceremonies, but expensive and impractical. My hair would grow over it. Only really useful if one day I get put in a prison camp where they shave everyone's head. There, though, I could potentially freak out the authorities with it, and maybe even process information the eyes took in. What are the chances I'm going to end up in a prison camp anyway? Am I going to die under torture in a prison camp? Is this a premonition? Every time we think about death, it's a premonition. We perceive it moving towards us. It emits waves. It has pre-percussions. We experience these as pain and fear. But that's okay. I know death now. I'm not afraid. And again, the thought of death again, but no longer so heavy. Light, like a black feather one carries tied in one's hair to move in the breeze. The breeze ruffles the surface of a pool of frosty light in my mind. I shiver. From the chill in the center, cold thoughts congeal into silver marigolds that amuse the panther sky, curled up under the roof, trying not to smile. The panther is a cloud of oak leaves from which drip oscillating feathers that sob in rippling laughter. Dave's back. Nate, he murmurs, grinning, strolling up to the edge of the hut. I was shitting in fluent Japanese. I warned Fujimori not to invade Ecuador again, and I prayed for peace. That must have been very enjoyable for you. I slowly stand up from the hammock and stretch, then climb down to the ground and lean against the edge of the floor. It was. You know, Fujimori's got a daughter. Did I tell you this already? Last time I was in Lima, she was trying to get me to marry her. I met her at this party. It was really hard to shake her off. Too bad for you, I said. Japanese women are hot. Don Joaquin says the women of the sky people are so beautiful that when you meet them, you lose your desire for human women. I can imagine that would be true if they look like Japanese women. Cielo japonesas, Dave muses. Japanese women of the sky. I can almost see them now. I had a Japanese girlfriend in my boarding school, I tell him. Up there, nobody had any condoms, so it was all about oral sex, in secret, on the sly. We used to break into cabins in the woods in 69 on the beds. I read an article on the plane as I was coming here that said in the embryo, this one organ develops into either a penis or a clitoris. So with cunnilingus, you can end up having a homosexual relationship with a woman, because we're all basically the same sex anyway. There's an awkward pause. Dave breaks the silence, murmuring, I have to be by myself now. He strides away in a curving path, leaving me leaning against the edge of the floor, thinking, damn, why did I say that? He must think I'm a total pervert. He's always going to remember me as that dude who has gay sex with Japanese girls. I've got to remember I'm not in a boarding school for the arts anymore, not in a violin major's dorm room with a David Bowie poster on the wall. The problem is my mind is full of thoughts, and they jump out of my mouth like fish. It's the storyteller's fate. Live by the word, die by the word. Nothing I can do but let the moment flow down the river of time. Let it be carried away with all the other stupid things I've ever said and done. That reminds me of a time I sat down to eat lunch in a Chinese restaurant with a Mexican friend, and I had something to say to him, and then it was gone. It was as if the thought had been a fish, and an osprey had swooped down and snatched it right out of my head to eat. Thoughts, memories, moments of time, events, all fish hunted by the ospreys of oblivion. Some of these fish swim away. Some come back. We can consciously recall them. Sometimes they don't come because they don't want to, or they're dead, or too far down the river. The river. I should haul some water to wash the floor of the hut in the morning. At the trees, I pick up a 4-gallon aluminum pot by its C-shaped handle and work my way slowly down the slippery bank, barefoot in darkness. Animism. Everything's a being, even thoughts, memories, moments of time, and the smooth, soft mud letting me walk upon it without making me fall. Dear mud, I bless you with my feet. Words, too, are beings evolving over time and space. They want to be used, spoken, expressed, instantiated, given birth to, reproduced. I reach the water's edge and squat down in the sand and listen to the river pronouncing its long, long word. My mind somersaults into a darkness of liquid sound. Doesn't everyone struggle with their sexuality, whatever it is? We're like Jacob wrestling with the angel. This is our holy war. Ah, these thoughts I'm having now. They're so fine. I won't remember them later on, but that's all right. Catch and release, as with fish. If I had a pen and paper now, I'd write all this down. But a light would spoil the trance. Better to let the mind move like water, rippling invisibility. I release my thoughts, aiming them into a kind of orbit so they might come back someday when I have a pen in hand. Their splayed silver tail fins vanish in the inky sky. I recognize them if they come back to me, though they may have changed. And if they don't return to me, they'll go to somebody else. Such thoughts have had themselves had by many. I dip the pot deep in the water and haul it up and out, pour off the excess, walk it back up toward the hut, socializing with the mud with my feet, letting the weight of the pot steady me. At Cabana Supernatura, I realize that I've forgotten everything I've thought about since I headed up from the river. The thoughts were coming too fast for me to fix them. I know this has happened many times before. What good is a thought if you can't remember it? Does it leave a trace? Joaquin's awake, sitting up in his hammock, talking with Dave. Dave hands him back the empty cup. Dave rinses his mouth, spits. I tread slowly up the steps and set the pot down. I dip a plastic bowl into it and wash the mud off my feet and sit in my hammock. Contento? Joaquin asks me. Si. ¿Quiere tomar otro? Si. He pours and sings. Under his voice, micro-demons flow like particles of dust off the cup until the ají is pure. Then he hands it back to me, lies back in his hammock, wraps himself in his blanket. Over the cup I sing, one of us high, one of us high, one of us high, one of us high, 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 high. Hundreds of small perfect orange flames appear over the liquid surface, spiraling clockwise toward the center. I watch them as I sing. Each one is curved and recurved, wavy like the blade of a kris. But as beautiful as they are, they're flames, and they might set me on fire inside again. The moment I think that, they become petals. An orange flower floats atop the brew, spiraling, the color of the evening sun on the horizon. I drink the power, set the cup on the floor, rinse my mouth, spit the water in a crack between floorboards. A light snore. Our teacher has crossed into dreams. Nate, let's pray for Joaquin, Dave says. We chant rhythmic syllables. A cumulus of healing energy condenses above us. I invite spirit doctors from heaven to treat any nascent illnesses Joaquin might have. 2 doll-sized men in brown robes float down through the cloud. Saints Peter and Paul, making a house call. They vanish inside the drinker's body. After a time and the work feels done, we grow silent, attentive. The saints float back into the sky. The cloud dissolves. I observe Joaquin's sleeping form, wonder what he's dreaming. Since our first ceremony, I felt he and I are one man in two bodies. He's the older Sequoia me, and I'm the younger gringo him. Now I'm the he who's awake, and he's the I who's dreaming. Do I watch the dark world with eyes that he sees through? Is the black green of our eyes flinty enough to slice the skin of this night? Swirling, the still birds echo, calling the dawn. A rooster crows once, twice. The air trembles with insect song. Dave laughs and sings, hey, 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 hey. I lie face down in my hammock as if in a net. My soul is a dolphin that sometimes surfaces to breathe. These quick surfacings are my lives on the material plane. I'm a were-dolphin, a swim in the myth of the world. Just need a stingray for a hat to hide my blowhole. While wave-like, reticulated like a python, the universe slithers into undreamed-of futures. Those who haven't seen as we have seen nothing. And yet, everyone has seen everything. We're just the ones who remember. An old classroom with squeaky wooden floors and scarred wooden desks materializes in my memory. The professor is discussing one of the earliest Hindu philosophers. So what he's saying is that there's only one being in the universe, and it incarnates across time and space in every single organism that has ever existed and will ever exist. The little nine-pointed blue star appears again, a sign, a messenger, a blessing. I observe it, admire it. It's for me. I sit up refreshed. Joaquin's still sleeping. Dave remarks, Nate, did you know that Guaranis and the Sequoias used to be enemies? No. The Sequoias were scared of the Guaranis because the Guaranis were crazy warriors. And the Guaranis were scared of the Sequoias because the Sequoias were powerful magicians. That makes sense, I nod. The two tribes also have a totally different attitude about sex. Sequoias don't even kiss each other. But Guaranis are all into sex. A lot of Guarani guys want to marry Kichwa women because Guarani women consider it their right to fuck any guy they want when their husband isn't around. I kind of got that impression. I remember Ayamo and the look she gave me, inviting me, challenging me to make love to her. Here's something else, Dave goes on. If you want to count to 10 in Guarani, you say, Aruki, Mea, Mea go Aruki, Mea go Mea, Emempuki, Emempuki go Aruki, Emempuki go Mea, Emempuki go Mea go Aruki, Emempuki go Mea go Mea, Tum Pepuki. Get it? It's like saying 1, 2, 2 plus 1, 2 plus 2, 5, 5 plus 1, 5 plus 2, 5 plus 2 plus 2, 10. But these days, Guaranis usually use Spanish for numbers instead. Right on. The Spanish system's more convenient. Okay, more Guarani trivia. Well, another thing I learned was this. When a Guarani farts, he says, Durani Koma. That means ancestor fart, which is short for, as my ancestors farted, I fart. They crack up when they say it, but it's deep. Think about it. Cool. What my ancestors did, I do. I'm them alive again. It's true. Speaking of ancient smells, Dave says, sniffing. Do you smell that? No, what? That tree over there. No, it's with it. It's a cannonball tree. Can you smell it? Now that you mention it, there's a kind of musk. Now the breeze is coming from over there. It smelled like the ball sweat of a ghost. Right, Dave says. The tree's name in Quechua is Ayauma, soul skull. It has these armored cannonball-sized fruit that sometimes fall from 25 feet up. If you're standing underneath, they can kill you. Most trees in the forest have shallow, broad root systems, but the Ayauma's got a taproot, like a long, strong spike deep in the ground, so it's nearly impossible for it to blow over in a storm. That's why Rufino didn't cut it down when he built this hut. Don Ignacio told me the Quechua say that if you want to be strong like the tree, you can run up to it and punch it in the trunk as hard as you can, then run away as fast as you can. You get really strong, unless you trip and fall while you're running away. If you do that, you'll die soon. Cool. Dude, you know what would be crazy? I asked, changing the subject. What? If we could continue this exact same conversation in another year in another Yahe ceremony. Right on, bro. I'm planning to come back here next year. Me too, Dave says. Don Joaquin said I could take some of this Yahe up to the States with me. I'm thinking I'll host some ceremonies in California and raise some money for a community project here. Far out. Go for it. I'm just going to go home and work, but I think I can get back. The thought of travel moves me. I go out and stroll on the grass. I don't punch the cannonball tree, just sing, one love is high. I dance, and information floats down to me from the sky. The Germans, I murmur. The Germans and the Jews. The Nazis were possessed by a spirit of destruction. They consumed their victims. They took money and property from them, took their lives, shared their flesh out between the earth and the sky. Maybe God wanted the victims near him. The victims were low in vitality, but high in holiness. The world has always dealt harshly with those who lack whatever it is that enables us to survive. The penalty being, of course, death. So the Jews got to go to heaven, and the Nazis got their stuff. That's cosmic justice. That's the karmic equation that's invisible to materialists. Everybody lost and everybody won. The Nazis were defeated when the forces of preservation of life allied against them. The gods of death raged for a while. Then the gods of life took their turn. Now, Wiesenthalic angels hunt Nazi ghosts in the Argentinas of the beyond, and the Jewish victims live a step closer to God in celestial steppels from whose wells they can watch over their relatives in this world. Back at the hut, Joaquin's awake. Dave and I ask him for healings. Dave lies face down on the floor beside Joaquin's hammock. The old man lights at full speed. He blows its smoke over the Mamikoko, then sings and whisks Dave's energy field clean. Each sound is beautiful, but the procedure takes a long, long time. I get impatient and jealous. Joaquin likes him better than me. I encourage myself to relax and or shut up. Joaquin finally says, stopping. Yeah. Qué lindo, Dave murmurs. How beautiful. There's a pause. I saw a hummingbird, he continues. It said, there's a long, long pause filled with the crystalline ringing of crickets. A rooster crows. Morning's coming. I hear Joaquin breathing softly. Me boo, Dave finishes. What does that mean? Responds Joaquin after a moment, distractedly. The hummingbird said it, Dave reminds him. Me boo. Another long, crickety pause. I put my hand on the floor, nearly stopping the movement of my hammock, then give the floor a shove and fold my hands over my chest. People, murmurs Joaquin finally. It's one of their words. It means people. Deohi, Dave thanks him, and stands up slowly and walks back to his hammock, whistling under his breath. Toanke, Joaquin says. I unfold myself and sit up and rise and approach and get down and stretch out on the floor face down. The song begins, along with the soothing, energetic flight of the Mamikoko over my back. My father used to say a Jewish blessing with his hands on my head when I was a child. A bracha. It was odd, embarrassing, but I let him do it because it mattered to him. Now I see the brachas have kept me safe by installing patterns of caution inside me and waves of safety around me. In my memory, I'm seeing the bracha from my dad's perspective, not mine, looking down his arms at his hands resting atop my head. Blessed art thou, O Lord our God, King of the universe. One day last year, the father of my old friend Murray came into the Café Trieste and told me about a recent excellent mushroom trip he'd taken with his friends. The famous realization from that day was when one of my friends runs up to me and grabs my arm and says, now I get it, I am my father. Another Imlakesh. It made sense to me then, and it makes sense to me now, as I represent my lineage in accepting a blessing from a different father and his lineage. We're all distant cousins anyway. According to the Hindu philosopher, we're even all the same person. Joaquin's blessing is clearing away smog above me, opening a space for an invisible light that shines down from above. Blessed art thou, O Lord our God, King of the universe, creator of invisible light, builder of the trees from which Jesus and Odin hung, and the trees for which Humbaba died. These thoughts hang in the air like my father's sculptures, allowing themselves to be observed from many directions. I think I see a flaw in one of them. If blessing leads to survival, were children who die young not blessed enough? No, it's not that. Their souls must be needed in the next world. They hit death puberty earlier than average. They keep evolving on the other side. By the time we die, their palaces will be built. I recall what I've seen in these nights, guarded from the ospreys of oblivion, the bats, the flames on the cup, the nine-pointed blue stars, the Japanese women of the sky, the eyes in the sky, the eyes on Dave's crown. I've been talking with that guy for 2 days and two nights.
Mm-hmm,
murmurs Joaquin with a final flick of the mamacoco. Go lie down now. Deoli, I say, and stand up slowly and keep my head down to avoid the dizziness that I know could knock me back to the floor. There's a deep blue glow under the leafy fringe of the palm-frowned roof. Dawn's coming. I wrap myself in my blanket and lie down, rocking from side to side. Wriggle at the crack of my back, observe the sensation of breathing, and relax. Not sleepy, alert, and curious for what will come next. Dawn comes. Rufino's three cows do, too. Our patience tests to begin. Dave and I chase them away. Fog makes a silky void of the river, swallowing the trees on the other side. All is cool, calm, and gray.
After dawn, Dave went out to fax another message of peace to the Peruvian president. He came back exclaiming, Nate, check this out. This is friggin' nuts. I found these super weird fresh tracks on one of the trails. He brought me out and showed me. I could see what he meant. It looked as if something with one cloven hoof and one human foot with the big toe pointed straight down had taken exactly six steps on the trail toward the hut. Don Ignacio told me about this, Dave said. It's exactly how he described this wicked, crazy forest spirit called the Chuyachaki. Holy shit, Joaquin's got to see this. But when we told our hosts about the Chuyachaki tracks, neither Joaquin nor any of the others wanted to go out and look. They weren't curious and didn't care. So what if a forest spirit came near during the night while people were drinking yaje? This is news? Later in the morning, Joaquin and his family motor canoed downriver to Sequoia, leaving Dave and me in charge of the place. We started packing because we were going to catch a canoe upriver at 4:30 the following morning. I ran across a letter Deirdre had written me. I reread it and cried for all the love that had gotten lost between us, and then between everyone, all the attempts to love that fail. I thought of Yumiko, of Jennifer, of Yumi, of Lily, of the blonde girl with the flute. I thought of my parents' wedding rings and wondered again what become of them. I wept harder. I didn't want to do any of this, I sobbed. I'd rather my parents' marriage had worked out. I'd have a younger brother or sister or two. I'd be in Ann Arbor, now living a totally different life as a man of the town, mainstream, stolid, instead of this edgy, tragic guy. Hey, bro, Dave broke in. Could you please stop crying now? Kids live here, and that kind of energy isn't good for them. Don Joaquin says it's good to cry when we drink yaje, I countered, stopping crying anyway. It gets all the negative stuff out. Wouldn't you rather go swimming, he said? Let's get our suits on and go check out that rope swing over the river. We went to the riverbank. This was the first time I'd hung by my legs from the rope swing and dropped into the water. Watching other people had taught me, and the yaje improved my balance. Dave and I took the vitalizing plunge again and again, only stopping when he started to feel nauseated. In the late afternoon sunshine, Dave discovered a tiny lizard, half the length of an index finger, on a sheet hanging on a line. On his body were green, yellow, and brown stripes, while his tail had a white ring at the base, then a black ring, then another white ring, and then a black tip. The tail flicked back and forth and curled and uncurled, following some inscrutable lizard impulses. A final riddle. Who painted the lizard's tail? That was worth hearing. That was really good. I was really blown away by that.
Hello, Jellicle and anyone else in the room. This is Judy from Kibbutz Neir Oz, in the comfort of my room, surrounded by a blanket. I don't know if any of you are stuffed up or in any form with some kind of sickness. If so, feel better. I want to record some haiku for you, so here goes. Orange sunrise, slow ascent over plowed fields, 6:20 bus ride. Early rise. Peek at headlines. Total body view. Just a second, I'm lowering the volume of my phone.
Okay.
Through chaos, a road of footsteps, choice after choice. A few animal coup. Room service. A fresh towel, please. Insert undercat. Dainty paws. Dog poses proudly on stolen blanket. In sight of front door, navigation through darkness, foot meets hedgehog. Something to smile at, the cool tile floor, crickets in the dark. Okay, now some non-animal coup. One group, then another. Together, wage peace. Leaves of the fruit trees rustle in swoops and surges, the morning winds. The sound of my name, a signal of this lifetime, earth embodiment. One more conference, not attended. Green fields and bike. Each time, a chance to start again, with more attention. And that's the story. Hope everyone's well, and bye for now.
Labyrinthine. I believe we're in part 11, section 33. Mm-hmm. The heroes were not currently on their lecture tour when they decided to meet at the Etienne coffee house in the village to catch up on things and talk of new adventures. The imp, tiny, cackling Rosalita, arrived first and immediately joined her fellow tiny panty bears on the game board of Spot On to cackle and gnatter their news. The blue and pink piglet Bella came in sometime later and found Rosalita amongst her friends. The two sat together and Rosalita told Bella that she had heard that something had spooked the shy and colorful Musai, Minnie and Maxie, two many-colored moose well-liked among the creature folk. Someone nearby was listening, and a gruff but friendly voice said, "I think I can tell you more about this if you would come along with me." This was a handsome brown bear sitting in an old armchair. His green sweatshirt said Mayani, but he went by the name Memphis. Well, our heroes agreed to come with him, and they went outside together. Memphis had his bike wagon parked nearby. This lovely old contraption was a three-wheeled bicycle with a small basket on its handlebars and a much larger one mounted between its two back wheels. The heroes got into the back seat basket, and Memphis began to pedal all of them out of the village, a fairly small place, and back deep into the white woods where most creatures live. They rode up a stony path, one of few in these white woods, until they came to an old stone bridge. Memphis stopped pedaling and helped his new friends out of the basket. Then he led them down a long rocky hill that descended to under the bridge. There they sat together. "I couldn't talk freely back there, so I brought you here to tell." Memphis's eyes were large and looked a little scared. The heroes leaned forward to listen closely. "The Musai haven't been seen in a while because they were spooked by hearing that there was a place in these woods where the colors were going strange. So they decided to investigate. Colors are very important to them since they have so many. They worried it might start spreading." "How do you know all this?" asked Bella. "I have a friend. I can bring you to her. She might know more," said Memphis. The heroes nodded yes and their thanks. "I have heard all about your heroic journeys," said Memphis. "I like how you say anyone can be a hero with some courage and pluck." The heroes smiled and nodded. Rosalita gnattered to Bella, who seemed to agree and said, "Would you like to come with us on this heroic journey? We would like it very much." Well, Memphis's eyes got big again, but he nodded many times. "We can use my bike wagon as far as it will take us." So it was decided. They got back to the bike wagon and settled into their spots, and Memphis pedaled on, another slow path steeply upward, eventually to arrive at another bridge. They got out, and Memphis led them to one side of the bridge, where he took a special note of some ferns growing near the side of the bridge. "Flora, Flora, are you home now?" he called several times, and eventually a girlish bunny nose poked out from among the ferns, and the hares could see a round hole that ran deep into the wall of the bridge, a long, narrow home within, with a bedroom at its far end. Flora came out, clad in a pretty green dress that looked made of moss and green leaves. Memphis gave her a hug and explained why he brought the heroes. "Flora is a kind of checker," Memphis said. Then she continued, "If any of the local creature folk have a reason to go into these woods and possibly be gone for days, they come and check in with me. That way I can reassure their friends and loved ones, if need be." The heroes nodded admiringly. Memphis said eagerly, "Did the two colorful moosai come this way?" She nodded. "They came about the colors going strange." "Which way did they go?" asked Bella excitedly. Flora put her paw on her chin, thinking deeply for an answer. "They said they were told to travel up six white oaks past the bridge and then turn left into the woods using the they were given. That would lead them along their way." "Who told them?" asked Bella eagerly. "They didn't tell me. Just their mission and the It went like this, and Flora taught them the so they would know it well for when needed. "I wish you well, heroes," Flora said. "Your journey indeed sounds grand." And well, maybe because she was a little wistful, our heroes invited Flora along, too, and after a minute of contemplation and another of tidying her little home for a while she was away, Flora was then ready and climbed into the bike wagon amongst her new and old friends. Then she remembered something and hopped quickly out. Memphis stopped the bike wagon to wait for her. Flora went and fetched in her home a piece of paper and a pencil and wrote a note to leave by her door. "Gone out, do all checks with aunt at pensione. Back soon, love, F." Then she hurried back and hopped in the bike wagon. Memphis raised his paw, brown furry paw, to let them know they were off again, and pedaled on. Slowly going up a hill past the bridge, and slowly as well counted off the six white oaks of the instructions. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Ah, there are six. Memphis turned the bike wagon into the white woods, and all took to humming to guide their way along. The obscure path opened up to their humming quite plainly. Eventually, the trees gave way to a beautiful, wild field of goldenrod. "Are we still on the right path?" asked the heroes of Flora. "I'm not sure beyond the white woods and the humming," admitted Flora. At that moment, all of them noticed a little blue tree nymph sitting calmly on a stalk of goldenrod. After greetings, the heroes asked if he had seen the colorful moosai. "Why, yes." "They explained to me their mission to find out why the colors were strange in a certain place and if it could spread elsewhere," said the friendly nymph. "He appeared to be a clever-faced little whispery thing." "Did they say anything else?" asked the heroes. "They asked where the copper mushroom was. They were told to take a right at the copper mushroom," Simon said. "Well, this was new, so they asked about it, and he told them it was not far, just beyond the edge of the field they were talking in." Now Memphis spoke. "Say, would you like to come with us along this heroic journey?" Everyone in the bike wagon liked this idea. Simon smiled his clever smile and was hopped aboard in two shakes. Memphis raised his paw, and they were again along their way. The colors began to get stranger as they rode along back into the woods, and they were lucky to have Simon to direct them, but even he was only doing mostly by memory. Eventually they came to a murk that would have halted them completely if Flora hadn't pointed to something purple and fine moving about in the distance ahead. Memphis paddled very slowly forward, and they could see 'twas a purple, furry, bowed dancing creature, and his colors were not strange at all as he danced with his various ribbons with seeming no cares at all. What's more, he was dancing beneath the copper mushroom, so they knew to turn right. The heroes called out a thank you, and he responded by dancing along in front of the bike wagon. This allowed Memphis to pedal along through the murk safely. I guess we have a purple dancing creature, and it helps to cut the murk. So they continued riding along through the woods when they came upon a crimson-colored bear, who was in a sort of workshop, starting amongst his tools. The hero stopped, stepped out, and said hello to him, asked how he was doing. Not very well, I'm afraid. You see, I was going to tend my garden today, but what with the light here being strange and all, I can't seem to figure out which tools to use for what. The hero nodded sympathetically and then asked if he had seen some colorful moose I passed by. I did, Melbourne the bear said. They had the only colors that looked right until I saw your purple furry friend come along. Would you like to come with us? We want to find the Musai and help restore the colors if we can, asked the heroes. Well, Melbourne then knew these were the famous heroes of legend and figured anything he could do to help, he would. And then I can finally get to my gardening and afterward get to a really good nap. Eventually, the murk gave way to actual night and they pulled up among some trees. Memphis had some blankets and pillows stored under the seat basket of the bike wagon, and so they were able to cluster and sleep together in comfort in the bike wagon in these wrong-colored woods, wondering where the Musai could be and how they were doing. Not knowing how much further and deeper along the Musai were, the dancing purple furry creature danced all night and watched over them. 34. The colors were still strange by daylight, but they found that by focusing on purple dancing ways, they could see okay still. So they got comfortable in the bike wagon. Memphis raised a paw, and they rolled along behind Perth through these not-quite-white woods until they came to the shore of a great pond. It, too, did not look quite right to the eyes of these creatures. Then they spied something sort of following them along in flashes and decided to veer from the edge of the pond back into the woods to investigate. Eventually they came out to an open green field where they found a little brown and white pup playing a game with a little brown and white ball. He would throw the ball down the field and it would come rolling back to him. Sometimes he would kick the ball in the air and it would land a far distance but always roll on back to him. It's a pretty good game. They rolled it up to them and said hello. The pup said, I am Mr. Brisby, and this is my associate, Mr. Eli. They introduced themselves in turn. Mr. Eli, who was friendly, bounced up to each of their paws and let them throw them afar and then returned each time. After they played ball with Mr. Eli for a while, the heroes asked if Mr. Brisby had seen colorful Musai pass by here. Oh, yes, he said, smiling. They played ball with us for a while, and they even tossed Mr. Eli back and forth with their antlers. He liked that. We are trying to catch up to them to help them discover why the colors are all off and sort of funny, said the heroes. Mr. Brisby looked around for a moment. I guess Mr. Eli and I were so long in our game of ball, we didn't notice. The heroes looked at each other and nodded. Would you like to help us on this heroic journey to find the Musai? Mr. Brisby looked surprised and then looked them over closer. Are you the legendary heroes of yore? The heroes nodded but said, anyone can be a hero, you and Mr. Eli included. Come along with us. So it was agreed. Mr. Eli and Brisby got in the boat bike wagon, and Memphis raised paw and resumed pedaling. Then after they'd run along a long while, they heard a noise in the trees around them. Didn't know what it was until suddenly a handsome little monkey fellow appeared before them. He greeted them friendly. My apologies, friends, but when I get to jumping and swinging from branch to branch, I forget about everything down below. The heroes nodded and then asked him if he had seen the colorful Musai pass by. Oh, yes, said he. They said they were headed for the place where the colors began to be strange. They're strange all over here now? Asked the heroes. Oh, yes, Jacoby agreed. I can hardly swing safely anymore for fear of missing a branch and crashing. Heroes explained that they had been gathering a good group of heroes to help, but they didn't know how far away the Musai were or if they were still following their path well. Oh, I think I can help, said Jacoby. While I can still climb, I'll go up to the tallest tree I know and take a look for them. He pointed to a tree nearby. So he began to climbed, stumbled, but kept going up and up till he emerged on the top of all the trees of the woods nearby. He looked in every direction of the weirdly colored woods and saw nothing, but then, there, in the distance, colors as many and as unmistakable as that furry dancing creature down below. So he came swinging down, swinging and stumbling his way down, stumble down until he fell and crashed right into the bike wagon. Unhurt, because so many blankets and pillows had fallen. He popped right back up, brushed himself off, and said, "Glad I did that now. I won't be able to climb much till this colors problem is solved. I saw the Musai, and they are very close to the wide, wide sea. That's the place to go." The Hurs are very impressed. "Even though you cannot go so high right now, we think having you along would be a great help. Would you come on this heroic journey with us?" Jacoby felt very complimented and agreed. The heroes in the bike wagon cab made room for him, and he climbed on in. Memphis, seeing how many passengers were now in the cab, unfolded out a safety bar to rest on their laps hereon. "As two little friends of mine say, safety first." Then he raised his paw, and they rolled on. Eventually he came in sight of a steep mountainous path, a rocky climb up unknown heights. This could not be climbed by the bike wagon, so all got out, and the heroes recalled their first heroic journey when they climbed in the rain and hurricanes up Mount Cloudy Bay. The heroes led the long line of their new friends, climbing, stepping, trying not to stumble among the ascending rocks. "One step at a time," the heroes cautioned. The heroes moved step by careful step up this rocky path, and the new heroes felt like this is how they would know heroic adventures better. The heroes paused their climb and told their new friends to look down the rocky path they had come along so far. The new heroes trembled to look, but did. This is what heroes do. They go on adventures to help others, they take care of one another along the way, and they find a fascinating story to tell at the end. That's all you need to know of being a hero. That pretty much sums it up, isn't it? Like, if you went and talked to Joseph Campbell and say, well, they go on adventures to help others, they take care of one another along the way, and they find a fascinating story to tell at the end. That's something. The heroes recall vividly how that first climb had been doused in rain, darkness, and a crumbling path up, and only by encouraging each other along could they continue. But their present climb was just getting harder and harder as they pushed on. They might have kept going, too, when Jacoby spied a little gray squirrel in a bright orange hat sitting in a tree watching them. "Have you seen some strange and colorful Musai come this way?" he asked. The squirrel shook his head. "No, but I can see them in the distance far yonder." And he pointed from where they'd come. Memphis said, "It must be these strange colors trying to pull us off our trail." The heroes agreed. But Brisby noticed the squirrel's hat was not a murky, weird color at all. "Maybe you would like to come with us on our journey to find the Musai? It looks like your good hat would be a nice beacon to guide our way." Brisby had noticed even purple color was dimming strangely. The little green squirrel put his paw on his chin. "Sure you don't just want my hat? It was given to me by a friend who said in times of trouble it could help, like now." All the heroes assured that they wanted him and his hat, and so they all climbed down together and found where they'd left the bike wagon. Well, the heroes might have been a little disconsolate about having to return down the unclimbed mountain when the next event occurred to fill their minds. They came away sudden to a seeming impenetrable pass of stones, rocks, and boulders, one it looked impossible to roll or pass through. Seemed like their journey was halted in place, and they were so tired from that climb. All seemed despairing when there was the quiet sound of wings flapping and a beautiful white bear appeared before them. "I think I can help you heroes out," he said with a smile, and he told the littlest hero to touch paw to his, and each to touch the next in line. Memphis, who was in the rear of the line, heard a whisper in his ear, "Touch paw to your bike wagon." And thus they all rose above the rocks and boulders and floated by hours and miles to arrive eventually to the shore of the wide, wide sea. "Unfortunately, I can't fly you over the sea to where the Musai are bound," Boyd admitted a little sadly. They didn't have a boat or any other way to go. That was when the heroes gathered their new friends around and said, "Many's the time we have reached a moment when a heroic journey is stalled like this, but we have learned if the journey is truly heroic, and when meant to help, good will occur." Bella, who was speaking, continued, "We must not despair. Not despairing is most of the game. If one despairs, one slows or stops or makes a mistake or turns back and does not go on. Not despairing means trying and trying and trying. and then you have a chance. It was then that the littlest hero looked up and started to cackle. And get at her. And put some more. Coming toward them all. Thwup, thwup, thwup. Was the famous shiny green-scaled Calgary EVC dragon. He flopped amongst them. He was not as big as he gets. He said after landing, I can bring you to the island where the Musai went. They got a ride by me, he admitted. I didn't know any were pursuing them till now. Hope I did not do wrong. The heroes assured Calgary he did nothing wrong. But if you give us a ride, that would be good too. So Calgary grew bigger and bigger until he was big enough to take them. The bike wagon rolled on up to Calgary's noggin and then... Thwop, 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 thwop. They flew into the sky over the sea. As Calgary flew on into the night, the heroes settled back in the bike wagon's seat basket, clustered together, not to awake till next sunrise on the beach of the island, under a palm for protection where the sea dragon had brought them. Section 35. The heroes got ready to go, but the Nero heroes wondered where Calgary the sea dragon was. He'll be back. Sometimes he has others to fly around or help, explained the heroes. Everyone was safety barred into the bike wagon. Memphis raised his paw and he began to pedal on into the sort of white woods. The weird warping of the colors here was even more pronounced than the previous islands. But Memphis pedaled slowly with Perth dancing ahead and Shelby in his glowing hat perched on Memphis's handlebars. Flora also suggested they keep humming as they had been. This is comforting. They got a feeling of rightness from doing it. Soon they came to the path of roots and rocks, a difficult path to travel even on paw. It was impossible for the bike wagon to roll along, and Memphis had to stop. Everyone pushed up the safety bar and climbed out. I guess we'll have to walk it, Memphis said sadly. He wasn't worried about the safety of his unique vehicle so much as liking getting folks where they were going. Flora put a paw on her friend's shoulder to reassure him it was okay. After a while of climbing in among the large roots and rocks, though, some heroes carrying others, the heroes, new and old, began to tire. Then Eli, who was carried in Brisby's paws, began to jiggle for his attention. He told Brisby his worry. Where's the little imp? Brisby asked the others. They all stopped struggling forward and began looking for her in bushes and behind nearby trees. Her heroic partner, Bella, wasn't so worried. Rosalita was indeed an imp, a kind of trickster coyote, full of her games and shenanigans, but she never left a hero's journey unfinished. Not once. And sure enough, suddenly in the distance came the sound of a wild delighted cackle and a honk, honk, honk of a familiar vehicle. All the heroes, new and old, hurried best they could up the path to discover the imp delightedly honking the horn of the famous Kitty's bow wagon. Like Memphis, with whom they were the huggingest of friends, the kitties, Yanni and Yanni, pronounced Johnny and Yanni, pronounced with a J and a Y sound, to differ, though nobody knew which was which. And Calgary the Sea Dragon, too, of course, seemed to know when someone needed a ride. So everyone piled into the back seat of the boat wagon, and the kitties made sure they were all buckled in, safety first. Between the kitties in front sat their dear friend Fish, Murmur by name, a beautiful goldfish, and she smiled lovely at them all. The kitties waited for a signal to start, and it came with the imp, when the imp honk, honked the horn again. Each kitty had pedals below for two of their paws, and a steering wheel they shared between them. Friend Fish sat perched between them on a little cushioned seat. To traverse the path of roots and rocks, the kitties had pressed the claws button on their dashboard, and the boat wagon's wheels had retracted and climbing claws came out. The boat wagon climbed steadily among the roots and rocks, and the new and old heroes rode with ease, enjoying their view of the white woods, its many very tall trees and wee sprouts, though the weirder colors of everything around them was troubling, and even distantly, the sharp, salty smell and whoosh, whoosh of the wide, white sea. It was Jacoby who noticed the white flash the heroes had seen earlier in the more distant trees and nudged Bella to look. Bella watched a passing moment and then called, "Hello, come along here, old friend." And in less than a breath, the white bunny Mesmer was hopping alongside the boat wagon as it came to a slow stop. Bella and Rosalita jumped right out to hug that bunny and the rest of the creatures followed. Mesmer could tell from the crowd assembled that her friends Rosalita and Bella were on another heroic journey. She invited them to take a little nap at a place she called Fern Cassie. Very restful, she said, her mesmering eyes twinkling with a smile. So they left the boat wagon on the path and followed Mesmer into the kind of white woods to come eventually to a great green patch of ferns, big and small, so many of them. Mesmer hopped right into them and the rest waded in too. They came eventually to a sort of bowl-shaped center to Fern Cassie, where the ferns dipped lower and more densely to form a kind of couch bed. And there was Mesmer's well-known companion in all her travels and adventures, a small, gray, hedgehog called Holly. He squeaked his delight to see these new and old friends come to Fern Cassie. Many of the heroes could hardly stay awake long enough to cluster together in the fern couch bed. Warm, safe, peaceful day, and their mission going well, at least so far. They napped. Early afternoon all woke, and it was time to move along. The heroes told Mesmer and Holly about their current adventure. Mesmer pointed to the ferns around them and observed that the colors were a little off. Holly looked at Mesmer and said even her powerful glow was not quite right either. The heroes invited Mesmer and Holly along, which they happily agreed to. They wanted to help. So they all returned to the boat wagon, climbed in, buckled up, safety first, and continued to roll along toward the increasing scent and sounds of the sea. Came out of the woods finally to behold the wordless beauties of the wide, wide sea. And there was someone waiting for them, a creature friend familiar to them all. He was a black bear wearing a handsome yellow bow tie named Shotzin. "You must come along quick, my friends," he said, excited and waving. "To where?" asked the heroes. "To the final island of your great adventure. The Musai are waiting for you." "How did you end up on that island with them?" asked the heroes. "Well, I was there having an adventure of my own," he said. "Flora knows because I checked in with her." She nodded and smiled. "Then the Musai came. I have to say, the colors were already confusing me when I met them, and they explained that that was why they'd come. So I paused my search for my friend to help them." Everyone nodded and listened. "Then Calgary the Sea Dragon came and found us. He was how we all come to this island, and he was checking on us, especially because of the colors. He also said there was a group of great heroes coming to help the Musai in their mission. The Musai said I should return to Calgary to the second island and fetch them, all of you, as quickly as possible. So Calgary flew me here and said I could lead you in the boat wagon to the third island. He was going back there to be nearby if the Musai got into trouble. So Shotzi got into the boat wagon and buckled in with the rest, safety first, and the boat wagon rolled into the wide, wide sea. Kitty's now paddling furiously to get them to the third island. Shotzi pointing the way, colors getting wigglier and wigglier. It took a good several hours to finally arrive to the rocky shore of the third island. The kitties paddled the boat wagon right up among the rocks. Further up the shore, nearer the edge of the woods, napped Calgary, the sea dragon. Calgary greeted them and pointed one of his green, shiny paws toward where they should enter the woods. "Let's keep up our ming as we go along," said Flora, and everyone agreed and joined in. As they went along, the colors got weirder and weirder. Despite Perth's dancing glow in front of them, Shelby's hat glowing in the boat wagon's front seat with the kitties, and Mesmer's glowing fur in the back seat, the kitties were pedaling slower and slower since it was no longer clear what was path and what was tree. The humming was barely keeping them along their way, and their heroic journey was looking perilous. The heroes looked at the weirdly colored, anxious faces of their crew and said, "Remember that we must stay true to our journey and our wish to help." Everyone even deeper, and the boat wagon kept rolling on somehow. One more roll of the wheels, and the heroes came to a very strange place. It was a clearing, and in its center was the Musai. The Musai were glowing very calmly, and the colors around them were the natural ones that couldn't be found anywhere else, the heroes and the boat wagon included. The heroes hurried up to the Musai and said, "You did it." The Musai were not happy, though. "Only here. We can only do this for a small area like this. We've tried, and the natural colors travel with us, but the further we get from the clearing, the less area around us stays colored right. For a moment, nobody knew what to say. Then the new heroes sort of grouped together and talked amongst themselves for a bit. They returned to the heroes and the Maasai, and Melbourne spoke for them. We've been learning all about heroes and adventures, and we think we should stand around the edge of this clearing, paw to paw, and together, with our eyes closed, and think about all the things and folks we love and their natural colors, and try to amplify the Maasai's colors. So they did. They spread out to the edge of the clearing, leaving the Maasai still glowing in the center, and touched paw to paw, and closed their eyes, and all set to humming. Mesmer and Holly thought about the beautiful ferns in Ferkesi. Melbourne thought about his garden and gardening tools. Jacoby thought about the many kinds of trees he would jump and swing through. Brisby and Eli thought about the big green field they liked to play throw and catch and kick in. Shelby the squirrel thought about his orange hat and how it was a magical gift from a friend, and it made him feel less jittery sitting up in the trees. Perth thought about the copper mushroom he liked to dance under and its coppery color. Flora thought about the bridge she lived in, the cool trickling water that ran under the bridge, and the ferns that were the door to her home. Boyd thought about flying over the bouldered path around a great pond in the White Woods, flying over the water itself, above the trees, and how he liked to touch paw with creatures and bring them on travels. Memphis thought about his lovely bike wagon and traveling creature folks from here to there. Simon thought about that field of goldenrod he liked to perch and nap in many an afternoon, listening to the wind, looking at the sky. Shati had come here because of looking for his friend, the dancing black and white panda bear, and so he thought of the many nights they would dance together under moon and stars. He did not notice right away that this dear friend, attracted by the humming and natural colors, had come to the clearing too and joined right in. The kitties and friendfish thought of all their marvelous travels in the boat wagon, on the sea, and on land too. The kitties thought about their friend's beautiful yellow self, and Murmur thought about the kitties' so blue eyes. Finally, the heroes thought of all the new heroes and the many adventures they had together and how lucky they were to have them along right now to put all to right. The power of paw to paw, the humming, and the love and gratitude all were feeling began to whoosh, whoosh, pulse in and out like a heartbeat, and the natural colors of the clearing began to push out like a widening bubble in all directions, and this soon spread to the whole island that they were on and on and on. Calgary the Sea Dragon woke up from his nap and said softly, "I knew those heroes could do it." The natural colors pulsed beyond the island, into the sea, into the sky, and the previous islands they had traveled through, and soon all the six islands, and the whole world was now thumping with returning colors. Finally, there was a delighted cackle of the littlest hero, and a click, and that was that. All colors back in place. All the heroes were laughing and cheering for, however, this situation had occurred. Why ever the White Woods had a cold or some extra love needed to be given, it's hard to say. Now everything was restored to order. And so our dear heroes all piled into the boat wagon, including Maasai, Shotzi, and his found friend Bower the Bear, buckled in, safety first, and rolled back to the shore. They met Calgary the Sea Dragon, who laughed his charming, gruff laugh and congratulated them on their success. "How about a ride to the second island, my friends?" he said. They all agreed happily, and the boat again rolled onto his great tail and up and up and up to his noggin, and he took off with a great whoop, 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 high into the air and flew them all breathlessly excited through blue sky and clouds to the shore of the previous island. Let them roll off before taking to the air again. See you on the other side, my friends. So our heroes rolled back along the path of roots and rocks, boat wagon claws button pressed, of course. They came to where they left the bike wagon, and all the new heroes climbed aboard it, and like a two-car train, the bike wagon and boat wagon rolled along onto the beach where Calgary waited. Since the bike wagon did not float, Memphis drove it right up onto the agreeable noggin of Fat Calgary, and he whoop, 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 flew it and passengers high up in the air, while the boat wagon, kitties, and friend fish at the wheel, classic heroes in their triumphs in the back, paddled below in the sea. It was a bright sunny day all around them, sun its natural yellow, sky its blue, clouds their white and gray, sea its blue-green mix. Eventually they returned to the island they'd come from, and all looked natural again. Calgary landed the bike wagon just as the boat wagon rolled up from the sea. The classic heroes stood up in their seats and said, "You new heroes have done wonderfully in this heroic journey. We want you to ride foremost into the village as we return in our triumphs." So the bike wagon with Memphis at the wheel, paw up to begin, bike and bike until arriving in the village. Everyone knew, of course, that the colors had gone wrong and that the heroes were helping the Musai to figure it out. And then the natural colors returned and it was time to celebrate. As bike wagon and boat wagon rolled into the village, everyone from the region came to cheer and cheer the classic heroes and their new heroes' crew. Everyone went into the Aegean coffeehouse to celebrate long into the night and hear the many tales of this heroic journey. Singing, and, as a sweet surprise, Bower the Bear taught them all the dance he had contrived from all this. Start out curled small, arms and legs close, head down, no colors, and then you reach for the paws near you, and spread, till all the colors returned. It was danced many, many times. At the end of the night, we find our friend Memphis back in his armchair, tuckered out from his adventure and all his driving. He may take a day or two off, but sitting in his lap, also all tuckered out, is Bella, fast friends napping together. And on the spot on board nearby, the imp hero was back with her friends, and they were cackling and gnattering to beat the band. Thirty-six. Maya smiles me immediately. So how did the weird colors happen? I shrug, edge away. White Woods had a cold, needed some loving. She impedes my path. I figured the answers would come along the way. Would? Might? Do you need an answer? She nods, devil's girl herself, then relents. Some answer? Aren't you curious too? Eh. Please? Okay. Well, it began when I was in a car with my father driving to the bank to deposit. He starts more listening to the radio than counting the bills. So I pushed all the stacks of bills helter-skelter into the fake leather suitcase and I left him to listening to Jump by Van Halen, swaying roughly in his old young body. Left the bank. I put the case on a banker's desk, him talking to someone. Soulard, I said, and left. Took a while to get my camping gear together, to get what I needed in New York City, and get out on those subways. One after the next. Slow, breaking down, everyone onto the platform. Next one's coming soon. No, it's not. Not till 10,000 people are standing on this blistering platform. But I made it. Too fucking stubborn not to. To get where I'm going, with what is needed, what I have is delayed again by the office I have to pass through. Up 20 floors off the ground, seated windows, all that, and there's an office party going on. Good time to get on the network, get that spreadsheet with the hidden tab and its map, and I'm about to leave when the guy comes up to me and saying how I should operate. His voice is deliberate, slows me down, confuses me. The air chokes as he talks. The colors thin. Maya nods, like it made at least one point here. So I get out, nod, agree, get out. Not breathing, right, colors off, but still get out with the map I need. I pause. Maya nods. She'll take this if I'll finish this. The map in hand helped me some. I made it to the woods and was able to use just one cube of LSD to help me travel horizontally. I get a long way fast, then less so, then I slow to a still. I stand. I walk. No more mystics or magics. Just legs. I walk and walk, seem to find about the one road ever to run through these white woods. A road in the white woods? My ass. It spooks her serious. I nod. Then I come to the well, and I drop in what I brought all this way, and that's when the colors started to go weird. There's no well in that story, she objects. It's there. No, Raymond, it's not. They don't see it. Creatures don't see something? No, they don't. Why? I shake my head. That's the story. No more. She glares at me. I glare back. She relents. I relent. There's more. I need the last pill. She nods and smiles a bit. 37. Next pages begin like this. I'm speaking aloud and later writing this down. So, speaking then, writing now. In between, typed those speakings. Now writing them. Then, now, ever on. It is night. Maybe it's night that gives me the confidence to think, yeah, I'm going to say something we're saying. The night has always seemed to me like an open door. And, speaking of open doors, I go over to that one in the night, and I push it open, and I walk in. And there's a little table, and on that little table there's a little book, and I think to myself, oh, I know these kinds of books. Oh, yes, sirree. I've been around these kinds of little books. These are secret books. Yes, sir. And I pick up this secret book, and I think to myself, well, whatever I'm going to find in here, it's going to be pretty good. And so I open up the book, and I see, it is, of course, about the travelers. Here are many lines that my finger covered in bandages from an event earlier that day that I will not go into now begins, nonetheless, to scan lines about the travelers. I begin looking for notable information. The travelers, well, you see, they travel. They travel in strange places, and they have strange adventures, and they meet all sorts of strange individuals. And I look, and I read that. Oh, this is the time when Marie, the schoolteacher, and her friends, the White Bunny, and the little cackling imp, were told to go into the sea, and they went into the sea, protected by the White Bunny's glowing fur, and they found something really good deep in the sea. They found a beautiful garden. It was an underwater garden, and yet, if you looked at it, it was filled with beautiful blooms. Now, admittedly, they were wavering in the movements of the sea, not the movements of the wind, but they were still beautiful. And there were rows of them, the way you would have in a garden, and things looked orderly. And then they found a little hut. And Marie knew that politeness dictated that they knock upon the door and perhaps offer a compliment, if this was indeed the gardener they found inside. And the door opened upon knocking, and what came out was best called a sea bee. A bee that lived under the sea. And you could probably say he looked a little bit like a fish, too, because, of course, wings wouldn't help way under the sea, but fins would. But he was yellow and black, like a bee, and he tended this garden, as bees are very interested in gardens, under the water or not. And so Marie said, "You have a beautiful garden. I've never seen its like." And the sea bee said, "Wow, what a nice thing to say. Where are you traveling to?" And Marie explained that she and her friends were on a mission to find this mountain that used to be near where she lived and had gone missing. And so the sea bee said, "Well, you see that green light pulsing way up there toward where the surface probably is?" And Marie nodded, and the sea bee said, "You go to that green light, and I think it will help you on your way." And they said goodbye to the sea bee and began to make their way back up to the surface. And I just decided to stop there and read a little about something else. And so I found and read some lines about Marie's brother, Joe. Joe was looking for Marie, who was not at the school she teaches at that day. And he was told to go into the sea, and he did. He told his friends he was traveling with, the ladybugs, the hedgehog, and the red and white, and the red and yellow truckie, to wait for him on the shore, and he walked into the sea. And he dived down deep, because he was a good swimmer, and he found down deep in the sea a woods, a real forest, beautiful trees. They were growing from the floor of the sea. And what was lucky about it was that within these woods, when he swam into them, the water didn't come. He went from swimming toward these trees to walking among them, deep under the water still. It was the most amazing thing he had ever experienced, and yet it was true. And then he came upon a frog and a toad, and they said, "Well, hello, what are you doing down here?" And Joe said, "Well, I was told to go into the sea because I'm looking for my sister Marie. I don't know where she is." And the two little fellows, who introduced themselves as Starbuck the Toad and Ollie the Frog, said to him, "Have you ever been to an underwater woods before?" "I don't think so," said Joe. "This is quite the place." And the little fellows agreed, and they showed Joe around. And he said, "I just have to ask you a question. How is it that the water doesn't get in here? We're deep under the sea, right?" "Oh, yes, we are," the little fellow said. They continued, "Well, when the trees first came here, they realized if they were going to have any good company, they were going to have to form a place that people could find and visit who were from other places and weren't fish. The fish could come too, but they didn't want fish." "They didn't want fish?" asked Joe. "No, they wanted a secret place that people would happen to find. And so what they did was that they bonded together, and the water was kept out by the will of the trees. Joe said, is that possible scientifically? And the little fellow said, you're here, aren't you? You're with us. And Joe agreed that, despite it being quite improbable, he was there with them, walking among these beautiful trees, and he thought, this is not going to help me find Marie, but I just have to stay with these little guys for a while, visiting this magical place. And then I turned the pages and I thought, you know, I have time for just one more little bit. I'm just going to open up to a page. I'm just going to dip in one more time. And so I dipped in and I found myself reading about Daniel and his friend the Tumbleweed. Now, they are big fans of maps, strange maps. And what happened one time was that they were visiting their friend Jacoby in his cave. And Jacoby said, I have this map for you. I know you like to collect them. The problem with this map is that it's broken. And they looked at Jacoby with the brown monkey fellow, and Daniel, the traveler, said, how can the map be broken? And Jacoby said, everyone who's gone into this map has not come back. Everyone who's tumbled in the way you do that has never come back. Why do you have the map? Asked Daniel. Well, people have learned that I am a friend of yours, and they figure if Daniel, the traveler, tries to fix this map, he's got the best chance with his partner, the Tumbleweed. Do you dare to tumble in? Daniel and Tumbleweed talked in their silent tongue about this, and then they nodded. And so Jacoby laid out the map in his cave on the floor. And Daniel the Traveler and his friend the Tumbleweed got into a crouched position. The way they would do it would be like a diver diving into the sea from a high cliff. They would dive into the maps the same way. And so Daniel would be back turned to the map, and he would execute a flip dive into the map. And Tumbleweed would follow. And they did their usual diving, but when they did, they immediately saw it was broken. It was a broken map. They weren't in it right. They weren't in it cleanly. They felt themselves stuck between a rival and not quite a rival. And then they realized there were others around them in the world of this map that also had not cleanly arrived and therefore couldn't leave either. And Daniel said to Tumbleweed, it seems to hold on to people by their warm flesh, and you're not made of warm flesh, so keep going. And so what the Tumbleweed did was he tumbled. He tumbled down to the ground, and he made it, unlike the others who were all stuck. And he began to roll along, looking for what was going on, and then he saw it in the distance. It was a glowstorm. And he was a brave Tumbleweed. Let no one tell you otherwise that a Tumbleweed can't be brave. He had to save all these people, and he rolled miles and miles to the distant place where this glowstorm was striking, and it was a broken glowstorm. It couldn't finish its cycles. And because the broken glowstorm couldn't finish, all the nature in this map's world was stuck. And Tumbleweed dived deep into this broken glowstorm that couldn't finish, and he let the parts of the glowstorm reconnect through him. Boom, crash, crack, boom, crash, crack. And the glowstorm was able to finish its cycles. It glowed and glowed and glowed. And eventually its energy was spent, and it diminished and diminished and diminished till it passed. And the Tumbleweed fell to the ground. He was a little singed, a little battered, but he was a tough fellow. And so he rolled back to Daniel and called up to him where he was stuck and called, Daniel, tell everyone to take a deep breath and push hard. And so Daniel let that order go out to everyone who was stuck to push hard. And for the next while, Tumbleweed just had to get out of the way as bodies were falling from the sky everywhere. Everyone got through with little or no injury. I closed that secret book, smiled, and thought, wow, that was something else. Section 38. A gorgeous, long-legged, many-colored spider coming at me. Oh, yes, please tell me. Know me. Know me, you, this world, me. I am what? Closer, closer. I wake up crying. Wake up in the hotel bed, the strange room, the girl whose name I don't know. She tried to tell. I shook my head. She sleeps naked, with one arm and one leg hanging off the bed, like ready to roll off and keep going in retreat or pursuit. Night doesn't start that way. She wants to be my orange slice, every inch tasted, sucked, possessed. A part of me loves this, how she wants me, how we seem to meld in our fucking. It's never been like this before for me. It was always me fucking you or us fucking, and the orgasm ridden like a wave back to shore. Always back to shore, always you and me, always us. This girl is different. I know she is programmed. I know that she's more like a dog learning his master's voice, hand gestures, moods. Yet, something. How she ends up half off the bed. How she asks me questions. I don't know. Like there's in her brain unformed areas, pools of curiosity, not tied to the task of obedience and pleasure-giving. Why is A first in the alphabet? She asked once. We were walking hand in hand through a strange carnival we found way out in the country, one of the Sunday drives I'd like us to take in my restored Triumph TR7. I shake my head. Can't you access all the nets to answer that? She swings my hand, thinking a moment. She's learned that behavior from me, but I do it less and less. They tell how it is so, theorize about the origin of language, but not why. It's called X's Creature Carnival of Mysteries and Wonders, run by sentient beings. Program 2, all sorts of small animals perform, run the booths, attend the patrons kindly. That morning we were in a club called Lumina, which can only be found in our city in the early morning. A certain street, an old diner, and the alley next to it. Camouflage? You see, I didn't know, but I did know that I often missed both diner and alley and ended up on some other street at 2 later in the morning to go there. But guess right, down the alley next to the diner, and usually a right turn then, and a set of cement stairs with a sort of deformed metal railing, and there's someone usually to check your ID and your explanation for coming. And you enter then, and it seems like there's a stage toward the back, large and old, yet all around you is pale woods. The music dreamy ambient this morning. You've come with her to dance here. You've come here to dream and remember and know better. She was slow to let go of my hand, but I make her. She knows we'll dance together later. Knows I have to find the books and do my work. Does she fear we'll lose each other? We're connected to each other by the chip embedded in the palms of our hands. It's not possible to lose each other by mistake. So again, a trait more than a function. An idiosyncrasy I didn't teach her is illogical. I enter the white woods alone, and the music diminishes rapidly as I walk along. I am... as I was taught, the only way to get anywhere or find anything here. Why books deep in the white woods? How did I find them? Questions and answers that are right, even if they don't fit, don't make sense. I... until what's around me relents and joins in. These woods shimmer a little, waver back and forth like a strong wind, release a little more. I'm now in the place of art and it's many, many books, miles and floors of books. The trick here is to concentrate, touch volumes, and see which ones soften a little to your touch, which nod, perhaps smile, and release to your chin. Touch one, and here I thought, how long since last I was read? Touch another, I am not for you yet. Touch another, you're getting nearer. These are living beings, wood touched with words. 39. You know those dreams so immersing that what before and after them, not distant or simply forgotten, but never was? A reinvented world with some pieces of this one and some pieces of others. At the desert festival, as I am ever in a way, my father and true love, driving our chrome red sedan, I'm walking alone along a long row of RVs in a kind of murky light, and I pull the door to one, and I enter it, step up and right on in, and I'm looking around for something, find a set of keys sitting in an ashtray. They seem important. Then friends of the RV owner come in too, and they think me a friend they haven't yet met. The girl with an arrow straight through her neck, it's not a toy or fake, it's been surgically added within her neck bones. The man with three eyes, and again, one of them has been surgically added to his forehead, was once someone else's, and now it moves in tandem with his, a microchip, a green one to contrast his two hazel ones. A younger girl, but her face is wizened old, and I can't help but think this was surgical alteration too. She feels old, she looks old. I laugh with them about something, but don't know what, because they only speak in click clicks and noises. Move casually to the door, show them the car keys I nabbed, and indicate it's time for me to drive somewhere. More click clicks and noises, and we laugh and laugh, and I wave my hands so friendly and jolly, blow the old young girl a sweet kiss, and am gone. Hurry away, hurry, hurry. Fear chokes my breath in and out, and I have to get back to my father and true love and chrome red sedan. They're all waiting, and I climb in, and soon we're passing slowly by that same RV, door now closed, and my true love is sitting on my lap facing me. We feel sort of melded together in embrace. My father points to the sky excitedly. One of the new fish planes is swimming the air, undulating higher and lower in the water air, tail swishing back and forth, back and forth. We drive into a big building, many floors, and through an open area into what looks like a pharmacy, and naturally get caught between two narrow aisles, unable to pass. but nobody panics or gets mad as employees and customers all join together to clear the way so we can drive through the pharmacy safely. Everyone's smiling and encouraging. I wish and wonder and don't know why the world I wake back up in isn't so very often like this. No, get back in there. Is that merely dreamland? No, that, this is really dreamland. Sure it exists, I don't doubt it. Walking through the white woods now, cool, peaceful, nearly completely still, save me, and a little breeze, glad of this little breeze, so I'm not alone in moving. Maybe hidden things are moving too. Does the world ever stop moving? Is anything ever still? No path, no destination, just the many varieties of trunks, leaves, grasses, bushes. Just light passing the long day to night's gradual embrace. But then a structure, the kind of which I've never seen, narrow and endlessly long, like an ancient tunnel through the woods. I pull and pull at the door, claw it open, it refuses me at first, like I am not worthy. I think, I'm a man and I'm of this world. I don't understand this world. I wish to know, but how? Is it my imagination will help? Is it my empathy? Is it my open heart when I open it? Door lets open enough and I squeeze through, feel like being sucked in and swallowed, but then I am upright again and moving along. It's somewhat metal, pieces old and rusty and wooden, heavy old pieces, strips, the ground sometimes smooth, then earthy, then sloshy and rank. Walk and walk, crawl, climb, and it's very quiet here. It's so quiet, my breathing, my heartbeat, my steps, and climbing along noisily. Come of a sudden to a lounge, smooth, many calm colors against a great glare, such as I don't distinguish floor from walls from other shapes. I slow, I in time slows, lean against maybe a wall and sink, 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 until I will to stop and seat. It's molded around me. I will stop. I am here. 40. Jazz lets me read aloud some of these new fragments, reads others herself. The sentient girl bothers her, and her gray eyes glare at me as she reads in her sweet low voice. But the living being books she likes, and makes me read aloud. These are living beings, wood touched with words, over and over, loudly, whispering. Likes the girl with the arrow in her neck, the ancient tunnel through the white woods. I've been there, she says, but no more. How old was she when I first found her in my bed? Has she aged since? She's still mostly naked, though I insist her into a pair of my boxer shorts. Shaved cherry pussy sitting next to me on my bed, reading aloud my aftermath dream fragments appendices is too much. Her tits are small but well-formed, her face pixie cute, but her eyes too fiercely smart. Blonde hair past her shoulders, unbrushed, at least a couple of ribbons tangled carelessly into it. We're awake, both of us, I say, when we've run out of fragments to read, till she'll make me write more, which I will. She nods. We weren't. No. You were looking for your sister. I still am. I don't understand this. She nods. Her nods are uninformative. Should we have sex? She suggests, suddenly, her voice neither dismayed nor excited about this. I consider. Isn't there someone else you like? She nods, calmly. More than one, really, but mostly Toby now. He is? Ashley's old boyfriend, I guess. He likes me now. But the two of you are still looking for her. Nods. Where are you now? Here, silly, with you. But you're with him, too. Nods. Where? It's an island. You're here and there? Nods. How? She smiles and leans her lithe, simply boxered form into me, arms on my shoulders, half my size, and completely dominating me. We're not really awake, Captain Crunch. Who? I try to retreat an inch, but she clinches on. Your name. It's like a cereal I like. I put chocolate milk on it. Ashley makes faces, so I always wait till she's around to pour. We're dreaming now? Nods, hands caressing me. In the same bed? Shrugs. So all that writing? You did it. It's there in your notebooks. How? Her hand on my cock, teasing, squeezing, kneading the hardness isn't easy to do. She's persistent, kissing my face and neck and shoulders. I pull away. Takes it all from me, pretty much, but I pull away. She pouts. Well. How can I help? Do you want to fuck me? A sincere question. Why? You're pretty. You're sexy. You're smart. I'm a virgin. Yes, that too. She nods like collecting data. Will you? Curious, like my choice. Does it matter? She nods, again sincerely. Will it help you find your sister? I don't know. Then why? She studies me a moment, her face intent on me, touches my face, my old face. Maybe we both need it? I see nothing. Wait. Do you love me, Captain Crunch? She says softly. I see nothing. I don't know. Toby wants to. That's good, right? I'm scared. She means it. You love him. Nods. Why me too, then? She smiles. Real. Sex getting real. Because it will be dirty and fun. I nod this time. I wake up coughing worse than ever. No jazz. Filled pages on my writing table. Look out my window. Push open the old stiff curtains to do so. Night, but not so late. There are people in the street passing by the hotel, shouting, chanting, carrying signs, voices both angry and scared, defiant, stream past for a long time. There are police cars, too, cops keeping the march from filling the street, blocking traffic. I watch and watch for the longest time, make no move to go outside or turn on the radio. The numbers dwindle after a long time, but the feelings in me do not. People in the streets means the world is rousing to something again. Good for some, bad for others. I don't know my place in it all. Yes, Jazz, we will, next time. 41. Sugar cubes floating in a pond. They kind of got away from me. The other guy saw them and said, aha, because he thought so. But he can no more get at these little lysergic treats any more than I can. They just float and float. Everyone else is getting ready for the exercises, putting on their uniforms, checking their magical tools, confidence, purpose. I'm uncertain my place. I've been watching leaders emerge and everyone else choose their places. I brought the sugar cubes to help me decide, and they were lost now. I ride my bike to where the activities will occur, pass through a tall building, through a bookstore, walking my bike politely, hear voices behind me, hurry on. I come out to an open field where the others are grouping, and I go to the leader and ask his counsel. He is reassuring. He has confidence, but he tells me nothing. I try to tie ribbons around my wrist. They mean something. I see others do this. It's hard to do. What tools shall I wield? What group will have me? Oh, my fucking god shit. She's between my legs, sucking me off like fuck, and the ribbons are in her hair, and she has me so deep in her throat, sucking slowly in and slowly out, and somehow me not quite coming. How's that? I push her back from her knees to sitting. She manages to graze my cock with her sharp little teeth, letting me out with an audible pop and a mischievous grin. No. Yes. No. Yes, we both need it. That's bullshit. Pouty lips, big gray eyes. Don't you like me, mister? I pull my shorts back up painfully and shoo her over to the bed. My old cock is not going to be practice. Why not? I sigh, silent. You have to learn how to train it some. What? Your fucking sex drive. Why? I want to fuck. But not Toby. Not yet. I'm sure he'll love it with you no matter what. You might impress yourself. Suck his cock that way and you'll see. I don't want to. Suck his cock? It's not that simple. So explain it to me. I lied. About what? I'm not looking for Ashley anymore. Why? I made a deal for protection. By who? It's hard to explain. Try me. On the island, Toby was bringing me to her, but I decided he was more important to me. Than your sister? Yeah. Are you sure it wasn't that you stole him from her? I don't know. Why are you still coming here? You could have found her. You don't need me. I do. To fuck you. Yes. Why? I don't know. I stand up. Push down my boxer briefs. Look at me. I am. Look at me, Jazz. I'm an old, sick man. No, you're not. Look at me. But she is, clear-eyed, sitting on my bed in my boxer shorts, too. I sigh, sit down. Practice. She nods. In dreams, so you stay cherry for him. Nods again, hint of a smile. Did you ever wonder if, while we were actually in that bed, if we fucked for real? I nod. We didn't. Are you sure? She smiles. Every night I would feel you feeling around me, touching and kissing, always very gentle. I didn't want to reject you, so I would suck you off, just like now. Every night? She smiles, nods, licks her lips for show. And that would do it? Then I'd you back to deeper sleep. You'd be smiling and content. It was enough. Why more now? She shakes her head, doesn't know. It's not one of those things. She's bonded to me, fucking me as a thank you and letting me go. I walk over to the bed. It's a pretty narrow one, always was. I motion her to come and sit on my lap facing me. We begin to kiss very gently. Her taste is like nothing I've known for so, so long. When life was a circus of questions, pains and delights. When the doors and windows all open, sky and stars outside. She kisses harder, more needful, wanting me to want her, wanting my fierce yelling hands and tongue and torso, so I forget she is young, whatever, and I give over to her softness, to touching her where I will, to making her moan for fucking me. I make her suck me again, but this time my tongue is finger deep in her tight bear cunt, and her suckings grow lighter and arrhythmic. Suck, 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 suck it down. She does, and before she's done, she's on her flat tummy face in the pillow, and I am driving myself in her, hard and fast and deep. Rent her again and again, force orgasms out of her, till she is exhausted. Young, she starts to recover, but I am done. Wake up, Jazz. Wake up, Jazz. Wake up, it's Toby. You're okay, I promise. What were you dreaming? Bags End, book number 6, The Grand Scheme of Liberation, part 2. An illustrated meeting with Sheila Bunning. Miss Chris is writing this down like I promised her because Miss Princess Chrissy did it last week. And it's gonna have pictures because Miss Chris is an artist and said so nicely. The first picture is of your old Pat Edgenon resting on Susie Coach. I was waiting there like Miss Chris asked me to. She and Princess Chrissy had gone to ask Sheila Bunny questions about Farmer Jones and Bessie Bunny Pillow and the Bunny Pillow Chrissy. When she came in, her face was strange. Hello, I said. Miss Chris didn't say nothing, and then I saw why she was strange. Sheila Bunny was with her. Miss Chris gave me a hug too small and sat next to me. Sheila looked down at me from the floor below. Hello, Beagle, she said. My fear got the best of me, and I yelled, you can't smoke me. I'm in exile. I haven't come to smoke you. Come to talk, she said, as she hopped up to Miss Chris's lap, so much for me having her out to myself. I like this picture, okay, except Sheila didn't have her crown on. Miss Chris said she drew it because she likes it. Why are you doing this for Betsy? She never liked you. She never treated you well, Sheila said. Because she is king or something on the Bunny Pillow Free State, and she's not happy, I said. Sheila looked at me hard with her purple eyes, and even though I was still scared, I looked back at her with all my braveness in my eyes. You don't give up, will you? She asked. I shook my head. I peeked and looked at Miss Chris, and I saw she was looking at me proudly. Oh, shucks. Sheila hopped off Miss Chris's lap and onto the floor. Okay, we'll do it. I hope you're right, Beagle, she said, and then she hopped away to Miss Chris's bedroom and back to Bags End. And that was that. I was so surprised that Sheila said yes that I forgot to be happy until Miss Chris was happy and hugged me and everything. You won, Eloa, she said. So I was happy with her for a minute, but then I stopped and looked at her in her pretty eyes. Mommy, I didn't win because it's not about me at all. It's about Betsy, and she's still far away and sad. But Miss Chris looked at me proud some more, and my humbleness couldn't take it, so I looked away from her proud look and told her that we should go to Bags End right away and see Sheila and get Chrissy too and have it planned. So that's what we did. This is a picture of Bags End sitting on its little chair in the corner of Miss Chris's bedroom. But my loyal readers know that it doesn't look like that at all inside. When we were back in Bags End, the first person I told Miss Chris I wanted to see was my friend Lori Bunny, who is also my newspaper's only staff. We found her in the bedroom she shares with Sheila. She was looking at her encyclopedia, but her look was very sad. Then she saw Miss Chris and me. Algernon, she said, all happy. Lori saved me, and we hugged each other. Then she looked all serious. Are you still exiled? I shook my hoary head. No, I said. Then Miss Chris said, Lori, I am drawing Algernon's newspaper this time, but would you write down the rest of it? Lori adjusted her cute, funny little spectacles and smiled a big smile, and she nodded yes. Then I knowed what her smile meant. This is a picture of Lori Bunny, and since she is writing this, it means that all is right with my newspaper, and Miss Chris has drawn pictures in it. Now it's time to go and see Sheila about Betsy. So me and Miss Chris and Lordell went to Sheila's throne room. I expected to find Sheila slouched down in her throne there. Nope. Princess Chrissy was slouched down in Sheila's throne. She was reading a bump comic book, probably from a silly brother Alex, and there was an REM record on Sheila's record player. Miss Chris got all funny now. Presenting to Her Royal Highness Princess Chrissica, back from his exile in Connecticut and other foreign places, Algernon Beagle. Then she pointed at me like I was supposed to do a funny trick or something. All I did was crawl into Chrissy's lap, and she scratched my chin very well. Out, out, dumb Beagle! See, he suddenly hears Gila Bunny hopping into the room. Briefly, and stupidly brave, Al looked at her from the safety of Chrissy's lap in the danger of Sheila's throne and said, "A little late, aren't we?" Well, Chrissy lifted me up and tossed me to Miss Bliss, who caught me and hugged me just before Sheila hopped through the air to Chrissy's lap to evict me from her place. Chrissy caught Sheila and hugged her close. Miss Bliss sat down on the floor cross-legged and held me nicely. Lori watched all this with her smart eyes and little smile, and she adjusted her spectacles a little, a bit. Sheila looked at me in her usual grumpy way. "All this trouble for a dumb pillow," she muttered. "Sheila, don't you like Betsy at all?" asked Miss Chris while she scratched my forehead good. Sheila was quiet a minute, like she was thinking hard. Then she looked up at the ceiling with her purple eyes, and I know what she was thinking. "All this time that dumb pillow wants to do one thing. Defeat Jones, liberate the pillows, bunny pillow feast day," Sheila grumbled. "And now she's not happy? Now she's got her dream and it's not perfect?" Sheila was getting madder and madder until Chrissy had to hug and kiss her and scratch her back to quiet. Well, I was getting tired of this. Sheila could crouch for a long time if she wanted to. "So what do? Do we go to see Betsy or do we try to find Farmer Jones?" I asked, getting down to business, and that's me. Bump, bump, bump! With a yell, and before you could pull the crazy kid alarm or bemoan your family roots, there was my crazy relative Alexander and that nice guy who makes bad choices in companions, Allie Leopard. Alex made a kind of leap into Miss Chris's lap where sat I, comfortable, till then. Somehow, laughing all the while, Miss Chris caught the leaping Alex before he crunched me, and she had us both in her lap now. Allie walked up to us the regular way and said, "Alex is happy to see you. He said he would have joined you in your exile for fraternal loyalty, but he was busy conducting the last stages of some delicate bump language negotiations to..." "What are you saying, Allie?" I said rudely, interrupting, but those weird English words are driving me crazy. Allie shrugged. Allie smiled a little. "I don't know. I'm just the translator." Then he came up to me and gave me a tiny kiss on my cheekbone. "Welcome back, Algernon. I missed you." "Hey, this is my throne room, not a train station," yelled Sheila, who was getting grumpy again. I was getting more attention than her because of being an exile and all. Before anyone could say anything more, there was the sound of marching just outside the throne room door, and in marched Sergeant Lisa Marie Chow, dressed in her Army of the Babies helmet and her green army diaper. "March 2-3-4. March 2-3-4. She ordered the army behind her, who was Raimi the toy tall boy, and he was sound asleep. "Army halt," she ordered, but Raimi kept sleep marching, and he fell over Lisa. "Where?" bawled Lisa. "Raimi," said Miss Chris, all happy. Raimi woke up briefly and looked around him confused. Miss Chris clawed into his lap, carrying me and Alex. Then she picked up the climbing set and holded her too. Her lap was no vacancy, that's sure. Raimi fell asleep, sitting with all of us in his lap. He's the lazy-backed champ, for sure. I think Princess Chrissy wanted to sit in Raimi's lap, too, because she carried Sheila over and shyly waited for an invitation. "Come on, Chrissy," said Miss Chris, and she made room, and now we were all in Raimi's lap, and he was sound asleep still. I was jealous of Sheila, because she had a lap all to herself, and I didn't. And I was the exile. And Sheila knew it, too, because she was slouched down in Chrissy's like it was her own personal throne. "Dumb king," I muttered, stupidly, mistaking my ounce of brave for a pound and bully Sheila for a nice little bunny. "Traitor to the crown!" Sheila yelled at me, and she tried to hop toward me and thwack me. Chrissy held her back. "Bump!" yelled Alex. But before Allie could translate, some more people came into the room. It was the Blondies Three. They were smiling those nice Blondie smiles, and I knew they wouldn't let me get thwacked. They sing the silly song. "Old King Sheila was a grumpy old king, and a grumpy old king was she. She called for her carrot, and she called for her jazz, and she called for her Blondies Three. La, la, la." Each of the Blondies sang a la, and then they were all singing their las together. P.S. Oh, carrot, yuck! I guess Raimi, even in his sleep, must have liked their singing, because all of a sudden he was sleep dancing around the room, and Miss Chris and Princess Chrissy started dancing with him. I guess that was when I knew I was back in crazy old Bag's End, fighting and dancing and music and expert lazy buggery and so on. That's Bag's End as I know it. The Blondies went on singing, the others were singing and dancing, and it was a lot of fun, but I had to go. So I slipped out the door, no one is looking, and hurried to my favorite place, which is Milne's porch, just outside my bedroom window. "Milne's porch, am I happy to see you? My comfy chair, my view of the sky, yay!" This is what Milne's porch looked like, drawn nicely by Miss Chris. I'm not in it because Miss Chris told me she drew it while I was in exile and she was sad for me. Nice girl, she. So I put her down in my chair and didn't think no thoughts for a while. Then I thought I heard singing. Was it the old King Shlita song coming all the way from the throne room? No. That was a funny song. And the one I was hearing wasn't too funny. Then I knew it was the midnight song of the bunny pillows. But it wasn't midnight. Then I knew I wasn't hearing it with my ears. I was hearing it with my heart bone. Even though I was not in exile now, that wasn't really the point. What you do, dear readers, what you do, I didn't know. Betsy is a proud pillow. If I went and saw her in her bunny pillow free state, she might not even tell me she was bored. She might even have me thrown out. So I hunkered down even deeper in my seat and thought harder and thought and thought. Then there was a tap on my window, and there was Ellie Leopard, and he was burdened with no strange kin of mine. I thought you might want some company, he said, should he? He came out and sat in a comfy armchair with me, and I was very happy for his company. And so, dear readers, I am not in exile no more, but what about Betsy? I don't know, I don't know, I don't know yet. Time to go see Betsy and alone. After all the problems I've had over Betsy Bunnypillow, even being exiled and all, I still hadn't seen her, unface. I started feeling like by the time I saw her, she wouldn't be bored and dissatisfied no more. Now that I was an ex-exile, now that my struggles had made trying to see Betsy legal, it was no time to wait any longer. The thing is that I wanted to go alone. I didn't want a big expedition with Shlita leading the way on her bunny cycle and everything. I didn't want Chrissy to disguise me with her magic or Blondie's carrying me or any of that stuff. I wanted to go alone in my native beagle and face victory or losing by myself. Nobody but me was in on this. I was the last to see Betsy then, and I wanted to be the first to see her now. And if she put me in pillow prison or tried to smother me or tried to pet me, then I would take it alone. Now, I know some of my dear readers may be wondering, what manner of imposter is writing these words? Our Algernon is a confirmed cowardice, say they. His motto is, don't walk away from fear, run. He knows that it's the little guys against the big guys in this wicked world of ours, and the little guys don't stand a chance. Who are you, strange artificer, talking in beagle-like English? Where's our beloved, fear-filled Algernon? Well, dear readers, it's me, and it's not like I was kidnapped by a mutant brave beagle, or that I fell into a gutter of liquid courage, or got amnesia. It's more like, I know that I'm right, and I have to do this, so I did. I decided to see Shlita first. If my newfound braveness didn't get scared and run away from her, then I could really trust it. So I marched right into Shlita's throne room, and found Shlita and Miss Chris huddled together on the floor, studying maps and stuff. I saw pictures of bunny pillows in a big group, so I figured that must be the Bunny Pillow Free State. Ewa! See, Miss Chris, all happy when she saw me, and rushed over to give me a big hug and kiss. We're formulating a plan to assault the Pillowville and gain entrance to Betsy's town hall before her minions can stop us, says Shlita, all importantly, using lots of big words and I think calling Betsy names at the same time. Shlita thinks it's going to be a war or something. I told her that Betsy would never hurt me, see Miss Chris in her voice, and I was on her lap and was getting my head scratched, so I was still happy. Then that silly baby Sergeant Lisa Marie Child marched into the room and saluted Miss Chris and Shlita, who she thinks are generals in her army of the babies. Lisa gave me a mean, dumb, draft-dodging beagle look, except in her baby voice way with lots of W's. I report that the army is whipping up very well. We are going to march up and down until I say twoops to dismissed. As for the beagle here, as soon as he has been reassimilated into civilian life, I will have him swept up too. January, February, I will march! I yelled. That's pretty good. You drunk beagle! Lisa yelled as she tried to crawl into Miss Chris's lap to pummel me. Miss Chris thought it was very funny, and she laughed so hard I fell off her lap. Now Lisa tried to call around Miss Chris to get me. Baby, you baby, you! I yelled as a man behind Sheila's throne and hided. Now Sheila and Miss Chris were both laughing hard, and Lisa was so mad that she wet her diaper and then started crying. Wah! Said she. So, just at that moment when things were the craziest, that would, of course, be the time when my nutty king came walking in. Bump! He said all around, as if this word meant lots of hello-friendly kind of things. It did. Alex says, hello, everybody, and he wants to report on the progress of his bump operatives within the Bunny Pillow Free State perimeter. Said that nice guy, Ellie Leopard, who walks a step behind, but knows a lot of languages, even stupid made-up ones. Dreadwolves, I must protest with Puppy Wing Wade exempt from marching because of his bump convictions. Sidita, who I guess had forgotten about me hiding behind Sula's throne. Alex said he's not a bump, so many they would probably waste a whole page of my newspaper to write them down, so I won't. I made up my mind in the seconds before Ali told what all that stuff pretended to mean, and the minutes when Sheila would get bored with not having all the attention on herself the way she likes it. I made up my mind, dear leaders, to run, and run I did. I run through the throne room's door just as the bunnies are floating in, all smiles, and I run and run until I reach the door that leads to the road to Farmer Jones' Bunny Pillow Farm, which is now the Bunny Pillow Free State. Then I stopped. It took me a while to catch my breath and calm down. It was as quiet on that road as it had been noisy in Sheila's throne room. Now what? I didn't have any of my Beagle Boy journalism stuff with me, or nothing. Just my eyes and ears and my memory. I hoped Miss Fitz would understand why I did what I did. I even hoped Sheila would. I had to do this alone. I walked along pretty slowly and remembered the many times that I had been here before. My mushy old heartbone missed some of those times. Being weeds with Princess Chrissy, even being a bunny pillow sort of with Betsy Beef that last time. What did I think I was doing? Was I crazed? Maybe. But I kept walking slowly, like my friend Polly L does. I didn't sing her D-D-D-D-D-D song, though, but I almost did. What was to come I didn't know, but at least after all this time, I was going to find out the answers about Betsy soon. Tramping to the bunny pillow free state. This story about Betsy Bunny Pillow and how I got mixed up in it has gone on a long time. I don't know when it's going to end either, because I'm a Beagle Boy journalist and also that Betsy is my friend, sort of. I have to keep on going. So there I was on the road to the Bunny Pillow Free State, which used to be Farmer Jones' Bunny Pillow Farm. Now, I don't know what a free state is. I guess it's sort of like Connecticut where Miss Chris lives, and I guess where Bagson lives too, only it's for crazy pillows. As I walked along, my curiosity and fear had a big argument. My fear made a pretty good argument for hurrying back whence I came. All my curiosity could do was to remind me that I was on my way to being the first on pillow to see the Bunny Pillow Free State. Though foolish in matters of braveness, my curiosity was smart enough to sucker me on. It was taking a long time, though. I walked and walked, and the road kept coming up with zero pillows. I decided to have some rest. I had walked a long time, and there weren't no bully bunnies or babies or even pillows, for that matter, to tell me no. And what good luck came of my halt. I stepped off the road and ran into a whole field of weeds. They made your humble old regular citizen fella pal Agenon their king, you know. That's because I'm their only friend and protector. Yay, king, they yelled a lot. Hi, weeds, I said, offhandedly. I don't get all puffed out about being king, like some bennies I know who aren't real kings anyway. I like weeds, and they like me, but they don't have a lot to say after cheering me a lot, so I talked. Am I getting near the Bunny Pillow Free State, I asked. Weeds maybe must be like some kind of plant cousins to the bunnies because they didn't answer using out loud words. Instead, they used their together strength to hoist me into the air and carried me along sort of like I was floating. I have been weed floated before, so I wasn't scared, and anyway, I am the king of the weeds guy, so I figured I was pretty safe. I felt myself being carried uphill more and more as I went along. At the top of the hill, I was gently slided to the ground at the edge of the field. The weeds all give me a big cheer, and then return to their blooming. Some people think only flowers bloom, but I bet they've never watched a big, beautiful field of weeds happy in the springtime sun. So, where was I? Top of a big hill, fella, and a long ways below me with a huge field of pillows. Fields and fields, really. Bigger than Farmer Jones' Bunny Pillow Farm had ever tried. I was the first unpillow to use my unpillow eyes to see the Bunny Pillow Feast Day. For a while, I didn't want to move. It was a sunny day in this strange place, and I felt like I should just look for a while. After all, I didn't know what was to come. Welcome? Yeah, right. Capture? Maybe. I decided to do more than look, but to look with my brains. If I did that good, maybe I could see things that had changed since Farmer Jones left and Betsy began. Much bigger, but I already knew that. The rows of pillows were as neat as ever. I guess Betsy couldn't or didn't figure out no new way to grow pillows. Then I wondered, who grew bunny pillows at the start? Farmer Jones? I think not. Were there always live pillows? Was it magic or morning ocean or a dream gone wild that made pillows who live and talk? But they live and talk only when growing. Then their talk becomes a whisper and then always quiet and they get picked and stiff and stopped for good. Until Betsy said no to the midnight song of the bunny pillows, their goodbye to be. And she escaped. What was I missing in all this? I wondered as I stood on that sunny hill looking down to the fields of pillows below. Farmer Jones must have been overthrown by pillows like Betsy, who picked themselves and so somehow stayed alive. But did they pick themselves over days or all in that last night? And what else? What didn't I know? What would I never know because I'm an unpillow and Betsy would never tell me? I knew I had to come down. All this stuff I didn't know about bunny pillows in the free state was piling almost as high as the hill I was on. But I know stuff too. I decided to think about this for a while. I've known Betsy for a very long time. I've been the guy who was writing about all their attacks on Farmer Jones in the newspaper, and that means I was in on them too. What is Betsy like then? She's very obsessed with her pillow kind. She loves lollipops. Oh, yuck! She hates balloons. She loves John Cougar records, even though he's an unpillow. She loves being in charge, and she gets very mad if someone like me doesn't listen to her, or if someone like Sheila wants to be the guy in charge instead of her. The bunny pillow free state would probably be a lot like this stuff. Betsy would be in charge, and there would be lots of stuff bunny pillows would have to do because they're bunny pillows. Betsy always let me be around because she knew I would write about her adventures in my newspaper. Knowing all of this stuff, I decided on a plan. I would go down to the bunny pillow free state and tell Betsy that all the world wanted to know how her new lad was doing. I figured Betsy would probably be all mean and scary that I had trespassed my non-pillow self on her pillow grounds. Then she would be all boastful about how good it was. What I wanted to know was if I was right and she was even on board there. Oh, fine. Me and my smart brain plan. Me thinking I'm like Lori with the smarts, or Sheila and her wriggly trickiness. Me going down the hill so confident that for once I knew what was happening around me. Me scooped up in a net halfway down the hill, tossed into a captured bag, and hauled away to who knows where. Dummy old me. Betsy's busy. As the story I've been telling you, dear readers, has gone on, it gets stranger and stranger. I thought my vision aboard Betsy made my mission clear, to go get Betsy from the bunny pillow free state and bring her back to Bag's End. But my plan went weird from the first place. And now I was in a captured bag, and let me tell you that being carried around in a bag is terrible. Plus, it was really more like being dragged along than carried anyway. I was getting bumped worse than my silly brother Alexander's made-up talk. Then the bag stopped. I was scared to climb out because I figured that anyone mean enough and tricky enough to capture and bag me could do worse if I tried to capture and bag my freedom back. I guess I fell asleep, a lazy bug sleep too, because when I woke up, I wasn't in the bag no more. I was in darkness, lying on something soft and warm. Relax and go back to sleep, if you would like, whispered a voice from the softness below me. For just a second, I thought I was lying on fluffy Betsy herself. But the voice is different from Betsy somehow. It was the voice of someone who didn't know me. So surprised, I leaped into the air and landed on another soft spot. Are you really one of the creatures she lived with all those years? Asked a voice below my belly. I looked there and saw a pillow with a big face in it. Did I jump this time? Hi, Bugle? Said a sort of young-sounding Betsy voice below me. Yep, yelled me, almost dog-like. No matter where I jumped in the dark room, I landed on a pillow face. And a voice, too, and voice, too. I was crazed for an untalking seat with no face either. Finally, I leaped into a spot where two walls met, and there was a tiny space of no talk and no face. And there I sat. The pillows in the room got quiet after I quit jumping on them. Where is Betsy, I wondered. And who are all these weird new kind of bunny pillows and faces in them? And why was the room almost all dark? Now, I must say, dear readers, that as strange and different as those bags and guys may be, what we are most alike about is being stubborn and not liking to be held back. That's what was going on, and I couldn't have it no more. Gathering up my shards of braveness, like scattered rays, dusk at sunset, I tiptoed jumped my way from where I'd been to the door I saw far away. The voices jumped at me as I jumped on them along the way. Where do bugles live? Does she like you? You sure hop a lot. Are you a funny bugle? Finally, I reached the door and pushed at it, fell through, and stayed where I was in the light for a moment. I couldn't see yet. I stayed still. By mistake, I said out loud the big question in my mind. Where is Betsy? From the dark room behind me, I heard loud voices whisper, Betsy's busy! Betsy's busy! Betsy's busy! Betsy's busy! I ran so fast away then that I don't think even a hop in that Sheila could have caught me. Before I could think straightly again, I was falling through a door to the outside and then down some steps to the ground. Nobody was chasing me, but I still felt scared being an unpillow in the bunny pillow free state. I looked around me and saw again the big fields of bunny pillows that I'd seen before. I even saw far away the hill from which I'd seen the pillows and where I'd been captured and bagged. The day was sunny, and the fields were quiet. What was I doing here? Was I crazed? Where's Betsy? I said, all frustrated. Betsy's busy! Betsy's busy! Betsy's busy! Betsy's busy! Saying hundreds of glowing pillows, whispery voices. They did this for a while, and then quieted down again. Okay, fine. Betsy's busy. Where? Doing what? I looked back at the house from which I had failed. It was Farmer Jones' old house. It looked terrible. There were broken windows in it, and the roof had a big hole. Well, thought of me, Betsy's sure not busy fixing up her new house. But, I thought some more, would Betsy even make this her home? After all, her exile headquarters in Bagson had been a treehouse that was outside, and she had grown up outside in these fields. I didn't think she was back in the fields, though, because Betsy is a big shot, like Sheila, and big shots like to be separate from their followers, and higher up than them, too. Another treehouse, maybe? Or is Betsy busy making her new home? Too many questions. I decided I had to find Betsy, that she wasn't in the farmhouse or in the fields. I had never been behind the farmhouse, so I walked toward the other side of it. I was almost to the backside when the most horrible thing happened to me. From the skies fell thousands and thousands of carrots down and around me. Oh, yuck! Oh, yuck! Oh, yuck! Yuck, yuck, yuck! Yuck, yuck, yuck! Sheila's best dream was my worst nightmare. I couldn't escape because the carrots kept falling and were burying me. I tried to swim away from the ocean of carrots to the shores of relief, but this failed, and then I remembered that beagles can't swim. Oh, help! I'm drowning! I cried. Oh, yuck! I'm drowning! Yuck, I'm drowning. Poor Elton of you. I guess I fainted because all of a sudden the carrots went away and I was in the dark and calm. Hi, Algernon, said a nice voice, a sort of node. Hi, Susie Dark, I say, making a hopeful guess. Don't worry, you're safe now, said the voice some more. Did you save me, Susie? I asked because I was curious and also because I wanted to say thank you. Sort of. I heard you yelling for help. Did Freddy Dark or Baby Dark or Mommy Dark help? Ask me, all excited. I like the Dark family. No, Algernon, I'm not Susie Dark. I got suspicious. You're not a pillow with a face, are you? No, open your eyes and see. Slowly I opened my eyes. I was in my own bed. Surrounding me were Miss Chris, Flea the Bunny, and the guy who talked, Princess Kisika of Imagiana. Is your old pal Algernon nuts? I am sitting on Nun's porch, a place that was a prison to me, and it's got to through my bedroom window. And I'm thinking about all the time I've spent away from Bags End, helping Betsy try to defeat Farmer Jones, being an exile when nobody believed that Betsy was born in her victory, and captured and carrot-rainstormed, oh yuck, in the Bunny Pillow Free State, and only being told in answer to my ask again and again question that Betsy's busy, Betsy's busy. Well, I failed to even see Betsy, or find out if I was right about her being bored and unhappy in her Bunny Pillow Free State. Princess Chrissy rescued me back to Bags End, which was good, but I had no answers to anything. Now, I don't want my dear readers to think that I have a grudge against my native land. No, sir. It's a crazy place sometimes, but it's mine, and I'm its too. What makes me mad about being here is that all these things I've done have come to naught. Should I give up? Is a busy Betsy a happy Betsy? Is it my business to know? This is your old pal, Algernon, writing at a later time about what happened next. I had two really nice visitors to Milton's Forest to see me, named Miss Chris and Leona Lyon. Miss Chris sat in my comfy armchair and held me and Leona in her lap. She was happy and hugged us both. Then Leona said, "Gird nicely," and gave me a kiss on a big old beagle nose bone. "I think you were very brave, Algernon," said Leona. "Why?" quoth me. "You were worried about Betsy, and you went all by yourself to see her. A lot of people think you're brave in Bags End, not just me." I looked at Miss Chris and I was really frustrated. "Mommy, I didn't do anything. I just got thwarted in my plan. I failed." First Miss Chris smiled at me, then she stopped smiling. I got hopeful. Maybe I would hear something that wasn't, "Oh, Algernon, you brave guy stuff." "Are you giving up?" asked Miss Chris. Finally, I had a good question. I think for a moment, but no good answer came to my brain. Miss Chris looked at Leona, then said, "We better go, girl. I think Algernon needs to be alone to think." "Bye, Algernon," they said with their girl voices together, and filled my furry cheekbones with kisses. Then they went through my bedroom back to regular Bags End. So, what now? I think about the whole thing from a pillow disguised days to now. What was missing? Then I knew. Farmer Jones. What? Ask me. Farmer Jones, said me again. But he's gone. Yes, but why? Because Betsy beat him. Well, she didn't. Then I remember the day I went Betsy to record her final battle with him. Just as at the sight of her bouncing down the road toward the bunny pillow farm, he appeared, all beat up and stuff, and running away to defeat. So it must be that the secret pillow revolutionaries, or whatever they are, had beat Jones already. So, when I went to the bunny pillow free skate, I was scared from my wits, but bunny pillows with faces. So, bunny pillows don't have faces, you dumb guy. Hey, I'm you. Oh, I forgot, sorry. Now, I wasn't sure, but I think I finally figured out what was going on. It had to do with Farmer Jones giving up and bunny pillows with faces when bunny pillows don't have faces. I tramped back and forth in my mind until my energies were flat and then gone. Why was it only me who saw all of this stuff? What about Sheila Bunny and Miss Chris and Princess Chrissy? Was your old pal edging on nuts? Just as I loudly think this, I heard a friendly but unwanted weird sound at my bedroom's window. Bump, bump, said my brother Alexander in his rebel against good languages like English way. Without waiting to be asked, which would have been a good long wait too, Alex climbed out onto my porch and came up to me where I sat in my armchair, and he bumped me all fraternal and friendly. Leave me be, you dumb brother, I said. I've considered my dilemma in honest English. Well, Alex ignored me completely, and I saw him looking not at me no more, but at the window to our bedroom. I looked too and saw that nice language-knowing guy, Ellie Lever, shyly waiting for me to notice him and maybe invite him onto my porch. Why couldn't Alex do this too? Come on out, Ellie, and we will gang up on this fake language guy and defeat his intent. I yelled some kind of praise, because I knew Ellie would do no such thing. So Ellie came out, and Alex said lots more bump stuff. Algernon, Alex says he has important information for you from his operatives in the Bunny Pillow Free State, Ellie said longly. What are operatives? Are they like bump missionaries? I asked suspiciously. Ellie laughed. No, they're spies, and they're in the Bunny Pillow State to find out what's really going on there. I looked at Alex's silly face. How can a guy who speaks a fake one-word language have spies? And how come they didn't get captured and bagged like I did? Bump. Bump, 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 said Alex, who got so excited that he said bump words and bumped my nose bone with his two. Leave me be, you mono-word crazy guy, I yelled. Bump, bump, said Alex, all unhappy, and he retreated to a corner of the porch, and he sat down to suck his toes at Ellie. Ellie looked at me seriously. Algernon, I know bump language makes you mad, but this time it's really important. I'm your English-speaking friend, and I wouldn't fool you, would I? And he looked at me with his sparkly green eyes. Humbled a bit, I got out of my armchair and went over to the sadly toe-sucking Alexander. Dear Alex, I am sorry for being mean to you. Won't you please join me in my comfy armchair and tell me your story? I said as nicely as I could stand. Now, Alex is not one to hold a grudge, if you say sorry to him. He was on his feet saying happy bump words and sitting in my armchair waiting for me before I knew it. For once, I was reluctant to sit in my armchair, but I went over and sat next to Alex. Ellie Leopard quietly stood nearby. Now, Alex, we must not be selfish with this comfy armchair. We must make room for our friend Ellie Leopard, said me, sort of friendly still, but getting very tired of this whole thing. Anyway, we all somehow ended up together in my armchair, and it was almost kind of comfy still in a crowded way. Okay, brother, quoth me, talk or bump or whatever you do. So, Alex, bump to beat the band, or beat to bump the band, or something. I refused to fill my pages with as many bumps as that silly kid said. Instead, I would talk about what Ellie told me that Alex said. He said that you're going about helping Betsy in the wrong way. Farmer Jones didn't lose to Betsy, and she isn't bored like you thought. Farmer Jones has won, and Betsy is going crazy. I asked a lot of questions along the way. What I figured out from it all was that my vision I have talked about wasn't as smart as I thought, or maybe my vision was too smart for me. I began to get down, and mad at myself, and sad too. What a dumb guy I was. I guess I forgot about Ellie and Alex for a while, because all of a sudden I was surprised by a bump. Algernon, you're right to be concerned about Betsy not being happy, Ellie said, trying to be helpful. But I made all this trouble and I was wrong, and who knows what's happening with Betsy, yelled me. Alex said a lot more bump words, and I tried to listen through my upsetness. Alex says that his operatives don't really know much more except that finding Farmer Jones is the way for you to help Betsy, said Ellie. After getting so upset, I started to calm down. All I've done so far, and my silly brother knows more than me about it all. Thank you, brother, I said, and I gave him a little kiss on his nose and a little hug. Alex made lots of happy bump sounds, but was smart enough not to bump me anymore. Then I smiled at Ellie Leopard and said thank you to him, too. He was looking at Alex, though. Bump, Alex said quietly. Alex says they hope she will get help from Sheila and Princess Chrissy and Miss Chris this time. After all, he wants to remind you, Farmer Jones is a mean guy who signed the anti-bump declaration. What, you helped me? Wait, Algernon, there's more. You see, it was because of this that Alex put bump operatives at the Bunny Pillow Farm in the first place. He wanted to make sure the growing pillows weren't being poisoned with a lot of anti-bump propaganda. He said all that hard stuff with one bump? I did? Alex smiled at me in a silly way. Ellie shrugged his thin leopard shoulders and said, I just translate, Algernon. Bump operatives. Fully! I wonder what Betsy would think about all this. I hope she would never find out and vowed not to tell her if I could. Alex and Ellie left, and I was left alone on the porch, sitting in a comfy armchair. I wanted to sit quietly and figure out what I could do in the privacy of my brain bone. At the same time, I was feeling more and more helpless about the whole thing. After all, what kind of story was this now? Betsy's? Where had appeared in all these happenings, even the outs of her fluffy person? Was I reporting the story or making it and then talking about my makings? What I needed at that moment was someone smart on my side and a good hugger for my weary self. And she came, and her name is Miss Chris, my beautiful adopted person mommy, who smiles at me like she wants someone with it, and somehow that's me. Hi, Elwa, she said in her special kind of my name. I was so happy to see her that I leaped from my chair into her arms and barked a happy bark and licked her cheeks and nose bone. Me? Oh, yuck! Miss Chris sat in my armchair with me in her lap. She was half happy and half surprised by my traditional canine actions. Elwa, why are you acting like a regular puppy? She asked. I looked at her, feeling all weird. I don't know, Mommy. I'm so upset about finding out that Farmer Jones won somehow and Betsy is crazy or something. I told her what Alex and Ellie had just told me. It doesn't sound like you know a lot more than you did, Miss Chris said. What should I do, Mommy? I asked. Miss Chris looked hard into the sky beyond the safe railing of the middle's porch and patted my back spur and think quietly for a while. We should get Sheila and go see Princess Chrissy right away. Why I did what I did next, I don't know. I leaped from Miss Chris's arms and dashed through my bedroom window and ran around like a crazy guy till I found a dog leash somewhere and then tried it happening back to Miss Chris with it in my mouth and then I dropped it at her feet and I waited, breathing all loudly with my tongue hanging out. Algernon! Miss Chris yelled, all worried, and she used my regular name too. She picked me up and looked me over from top to bottom. Check me out. Mommy, I asked quietly. Yes, Elwa. Oh, doggy, yuck! Yelled me so loud and hard that I fell out of Miss Chris's arms and onto the hard floor of the men's porch. Miss Chris picked me up right away and she hugged me and holded me and said nice comforting things to me. She babied me so much that like a baby, I fell right asleep. When I waked up, I was in a familiar room. I couldn't remember where right away. I looked around carefully and sniffed carefully too. There were R.E.M. posters on the wall, and it smelled like a very sweet princess I know. Something was wrong with my eyes, too, because I couldn't see no colors, and everything looked soft and sort of flat. A really pretty girl hurried over to me. She sat down on the edge of the bed I was on. Moo, 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 she asked. Now, what kind of language is this? She put her hand near my face, and I sniffed it carefully. It sniffed friendly, so I licked it. Algernon, what is wrong with you? She asked. Princess Chrissy asked. Well, all the colors came back from where they were hiding. I knew where I was. Chrissy, please don't get mad, but I do have my principles. Oh, hand, yuck! Bellowed me. Chrissy smiled and said, that was a good trick, Algernon. You fooled me a lot. Chrissy, I wasn't, acting. I am full of weird. Miss Chris came into the room then. She was wearing a white shirt over her regular one, and she had her doctor's bag, so she was Dr. Miss Chris. Before anyone could say anything, Sheila Bunny came hopping in, with not her dress on. On her back sat this little furry green guy with friendly eyes and face, but no body. They were Dr. Purple Purple Eyes and Dr. Green Face. Algernon, all the doctors and bags in have come to check on you and figure out what is wrong, said Chrissy. Boy, this didn't sound good. I got scared and ran away from all of them, and down the stairs, out the castle front door, and hopped on Sheila's Bunny Cycle Beatrix and yelled for her to please help me escape. Yeah, right. That dumb cycle ruined her life, giving me hope, but then it just war-hopped into the castle and up the stairs and back to Chrissy's room, where it dumped me on the bed and then left. The doctors had me trapped. End of part 2.
Poor Elmer.
It's an epic story. It's an epic story. It goes on and on. It goes on and on. I think it's actually part four. I mean, this is an unbelievably epic story. I was writing this in 95. That's really funny. I'm reading the stories from 95 and there was a 95 Joker Guild flashback. Yeah, that was fun. It amazes me that I used to read the nights of the stories at the Jellicoe Guilds, and they were long. They were like that. I'd read for an hour. People used to grieve, they'd listen, they'd drink. I mean, I never thought twice about it. You know, it didn't occur to me. I just figured they're good stories. And, what else do you have to do? You hear. And, like, everybody took a turn, and everybody took many turns, and everybody took as many turns as they wanted to. There was no, like, sometimes people had to leave early for some reason or another, but mostly people were there till we got thrown out, like, 1 a.m. Well, they were fun times. Or, I don't know, they were fun moments. I mean, they weren't actually fun times. But they were fun moments, and I'm really grateful for them. Happiness, as much as it was achieved in the company of friends. In like those situations, those situations were the happiest moments that we all knew for the most part, because we didn't have satisfying jobs or nice houses or nice partners or anything. We're mostly, bereft of those kind of things, but in the company of each other on those nights, we felt companioned and accepted and appreciated and celebrated. I mean, that's what was important about those nights, is that, like, if it weren't for those nights, if you take those away, then you just have the rest. And I think that they were, I think they mattered. I think they mattered because, like, honestly, most people are not ever celebrated. Most people are not ever appreciated for their talents or skills. I mean, it's like most people just allow themselves to be sort of integrated into society, and they figure out the piece of themselves that they can market and sell. It's not very satisfying what they do, and then the rest just kind of like fades away, like the stuff that they thought about in their youth and young adulthood. It just kind of like drifts away, and they let it. And so I think that people should be celebrated. I think, like, everybody has something to offer of some kind. I'm convinced of this. I'm convinced there's no super human computer-brained person walking around that does not have something unique in it, that, like, some potential of some kind, some talent, some native skill, something that's not something that's just punch a clock-ish, something beyond that, something that's it's special. I've always believed that, and I've always believed that, like, our society really is, like, has this schizophrenic relationship with special skills and gifts and abilities. It's like, either you're on the stage in one form or another and entertaining, or you're in the audience. And if you're in the audience, then you shut up and clap, to paraphrase a Dixie Chicks line. You're either up there performing, back here clapping. And if you're back here clapping, then that's it. You're a clapper. That's what you are. We just have a prejudice against intelligence and intellectuality and sensitivity and gift. I mean, it's just like, I just see it over and over again. That it's just like a sort of like a people want to be normal, and they want to be like everyone else. And it's like, right, and all those people around you who are fucking happy, all those happy people you want to be like, you know, it's a fucking lie. And it's impossible to tell people. It's like, you want to be like people around you, and they're not happy, and you're not happy, so why don't you just try something fucking different? Why don't you just try something different? You know, try not assimilating. You know, assimilating is easier, but in the end, it's not, because it's kind of like cheap food. It fills you up, but doesn't satisfy you. So those nights, like, they mattered, and I knew they mattered, because I knew that the people around me, I knew that in their rest of their lives, that I couldn't do anything about. I didn't have the money or the influence or the anything to do anything for them, but I could celebrate the fact that they could express themselves uniquely and specially. And that seemed awfully fucking important, because I knew that in the rest of their lives they were just fucking drones. I mean, even if they were colorful and interesting and well-spoken, they were drones. They had no choice. Because unless you're from money, you're punching a clock somewhere. And generally, if you're punching a clock, you're often as not punching a clock that really interests you all that much, but it's paying your bills. And it's probably not paying your bills all that well. It's not like you're ever getting ahead. It's just, you know, it's kind of like a job is kind of like an apartment. You're just renting safety. You're not ever getting anywhere. So those times with those people, like, they matter to me, and I didn't know how to say it. I didn't know how to say it, because it's like I could, maybe what it was, I could reconcile. Maybe because I had it from really young, I could reconcile the idea of having a part of your life that was sacred or special or whatever, and then having the rest of your life that you kind of peak that with. I could do that. I don't think that that's necessarily an easy thing to do. I think that some people would rather just not have that bifurcation. They would just rather not have to deal with the fact that, yes, I have this specialist gift, I have this special skill, but then I go to this job and I'm nobody. You know, it's like, it's hard to reconcile being special with being just another person and being okay with it. Like, sort of like having a kind of like a way of operating so that when you're in one environment, this comes to the fore, when you're in another environment, that comes to the fore, but it's all part of your complex makeup. It's okay to have all of these things. It's okay to be an artist. That is the end of the Jellicle Guild meeting for December. Oh, it's Christmas. Merry Christmas, for whatever that means. 24th, 25th, 2016, meeting number 137. Thank you. It was a very fun meeting. And peace to all and good night.